Já com 15 minutos de atraso, acho que já vai sendo tempo, não? Então, muito boa tarde, eu sou Luísa Meireles, trabalho no Expresso, sou jornalista, redatora principal do Expresso e tenho muito prazer de estar aqui a tratar de um tema, de um debate que não é bem este que está ali, porque o tema deste painel, como vocês sabem, é debates atuais no constitucionalismo europeu. E eu achei que isto é um tema bastante académico e teórico, mas que pela força das coisas e pela força daquilo que está a acontecer da atualidade se torna quase uma notícia. E isto sou eu a falar como jornalista. Temos aqui três especialistas, investigadores, professores, com obra feita na matéria e que nos vão falar sobre este tema. Robert Elgee, de Dublin, que nos vai falar precisamente sobre o semipresidencialismo e a governabilidade. Devo dizer que Elgee, o professor Elgee, é precisamente conhecido mundialmente pelos seus trabalhos em torno do semipresidencialismo. Depois temos Carlos Closa, do Instituto de Políticas e Biénios Públicos de Espanha, e também esteve no Instituto de Florença, não é verdade? E que nos falará sobre o duplo desafio constitucional, que é a secessão de Estados no contexto da União Europeia. Como membro de Espanha, como espanhol, tem com certeza uma acuidade acrescida sobre esse problema. E finalmente a Marina Costa Lobo, do Instituto de Ciências Sociais de Lisboa, que nos traz a sua reflexão sobre a dinâmica do semipresidencialismo europeu na crise do euro. Se me permitem, eu só gostaria de dizer o seguinte, é que, como tenho, enfim, cobri durante algum tempo, ou durante bastante tempo, do ponto de vista profissional, a atividade presidencial. Hoje, nós podemos constatar que, da análise dos casos existentes na União Europeia ou na Europa, existem dos três regimes ou sistemas, parlamentarismo, presidencialismo ou semipresidencialismo, o dominante na União Europeia é o parlamentarismo. O presidencialismo é uma exceção, com um único país, Chipre, e o semipresidencialismo vigora em 12 países, sendo certo que em cada um deles existe uma interpretação ou uma maneira de inovar o presidencialismo ou de viver o semipresidencialismo, quero dizer, ao mesmo tempo que viveu as suas próprias, dentro de cada país, ele sofreu a sua própria evolução. E é por isso que eu acho que em Portugal, e pensando no caso português, nós temos um caso muito típico de que ocorre perante os nossos olhos, de que sem ter havido uma mudança constitucional, sem ter havido alterações de fundo na Constituição, nós sabemos que o papel do Presidente é crucial, finalmente, apesar de um regime semipresidencialista, ele de facto detém o poder de, como tal, não é? É uma definição, como tal, detém a bomba atómica do regime, ao poder dissolver a Assembleia e ou o Governo em determinadas circunstâncias, mas depende sobretudo de como ele o exerce. E se olharmos para a nossa história recente, verificamos que se Cavaco Silva tinha uma interpretação muito restrita dos seus poderes constitucionais, em boa verdade, isso não o impediu na prática de ser também e, de certa maneira, um co-legislador, através do seu trabalho, se atendermos ao papel que todos os presidentes exercem, a maior ou menor grau, no concerto da legislação, nomeadamente dos decretos-leis do Governo. Hoje, nós temos um presidente que está no seu oposto, que estica ao máximo a corda da intervenção, ao ponto de já haver quem diga que ele até está a usurpar competências, embora ontem na entrevista que deu o Primeiro-Ministro tenha dito que não se revê em tal, que não se acha minimamente beliscado, mas acha que há gente que acha que ele está a exercer, até está a exercer um pouco um papel de Primeiro-Ministro, de co-exercer o papel de Primeiro-Ministro. Mas isto é Portugal. Portanto, nós temos como isto se torna atual, estes temas do constitucionalismo se tornam atuais, porque se nós virmos o que aconteceu de um domingo em Itália, em que foi chumbado um referendo constitucional, supostamente para simplificar um processo decisório e até diminuir o número de políticos, que digamos que seria um apelo a umas tendências mais populistas, foi chumbado largamente e não se pode dizer que um país que em 78, que em 71 anos teve 65 governos não decide de facto de uma reforma constitucional. À partida parece que sim, mas os eleitores negaram-na, mas também nós sabemos que a negaram por um conjunto de razões que não têm necessariamente a ver com esta reforma constitucional. Espanha. Temos aqui um dos nossos oradores, que é espanhol, mas é um outro regime parlamentar cujos equilíbrios internos tornam urgente, ou nomeadamente a emergência dos novos partidos com assento parlamentar, colocam em causa a Constituição, no sentido que todos os partidos reconhecem hoje que é necessário rever a Constituição. E não estou a mentir, pois não. E acho que provavelmente as dificuldades de entendimento ou das plataformas destes partidos se entenderem ao nível parlamentar que torna mais complexo o problema. Mas a vontade de independência da Catalunha há muito tempo que espreita, é possível travá-la, é possível travar a independência da Escócia ou de outras regiões, que há muitas no espaço da União Europeia, que também aspiram à independência ou quer-se travar, não se quer, é possível haver uma resposta transversal de um ponto de vista legislativo, constitucional, para isto, ou cada país tem que encontrar o regime que melhor se adapta às suas circunstâncias. Eu acho que nós estamos a viver de novo um tempo de aceleração da história, como já um dia foi dito a propósito de 1989, e acho que a emergência da velha dicotomia de nacionalismo versus internacionalismo tornam de novo tudo isto notícia. E é por isso que eu acho que nós devemos olhar e ouvir com especial atenção estes três investigadores, estes três peritos que aqui vêm partilhar connosco o seu saber. Portanto, Mr. Robert Elgee, please.
First of all, let me say what a great honour it is to be invited to this conference. So I want to extend my thanks to Marina for that invitation. It's just a wonderful building, just a wonderful atmosphere, and the hospitality has been magnificent. So I just want to extend my thanks to all the organisers and to the committee. I also want to begin by apologising for the fact that I'm going to be speaking in English, because believe me, you just don't want to hear me try Portuguese, so it's just best for all of us. And there are some good headsets. I would actually like to commend the interpreters who I've been listening to for the Portuguese presentations for their work translating into English, and I'm sure that they're just as good translating from English into Portuguese. So if I recommend the headsets there. So I'm talking about semi-presidentialism and governability. And I just want to begin by putting semi-presidentialism in its context, and indeed in its Portuguese context. In one sense, you don't need me to tell you this, but I think sometimes it's good to step back and just take stock of where we came from and where we are now. So you know, we're here celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Portuguese Constitution, and Portuguese constitution established a semi-presidential system. And in 1976, there were only five other semi-presidential countries, Austria, France, Iceland, Ireland, and Senegal, which is typically forgotten or left off the list at that time. So there were very few semi-presidential countries to actually observe when Portugal was choosing its system in 1976. And really, of those five countries, we only knew something about France. I mean, I don't think many people would have been able to tell you a lot about the Irish or the Icelandic, never mind the Senegalese systems. And in fact, what we even knew about France in 1976 wasn't very great, because that was 10 years before the famous first period of cohabitation in France. So the perception that people had about France and the French system in 1976 was different from the one that we have now. Moreover, in 1976, as you well know, and in the language of political science, or at least in the language of Shugart and Carey, Portugal chose a particular subtype of semi-presidentialism, a president-parliamentary subtype or form of semi-presidentialism. And I guess at that time, a very small set of countries, and president parliamentarism was actually the modal category. But nonetheless, I think it's fair to say that, that certainly the term had not even been invented then. And also, in 1976, I don't think people would have had really a sense at all of what president parliamentarism meant or what its implications might be. So I think we can genuinely say that, you know, 40 years ago, Portugal was taking, in some senses, for its own reasons, for its own contextual and historical reasons, but it was taking some sort of constitutional leap in the dark, and even if there were very fine constitutional lawyers who were helping to craft that system. But things now are different. 40 years on, things are very different. There are now not just 5 or 6 semi-presidential countries. At the last count, there are 54, with Moldova being the most recent acquisition to that list, which means that there are just about as many semi-presidential countries with a semi-presidential constitution as there are countries with a presidential constitution on the one hand and a parliamentary constitution on the other. So semi-presidentialism has pretty much become the mainstream. Also, in 1982, as again you very well know, Portugal changed its subtype of semi-presidentialism to being what in the jargon is called a premier presidential type. And now this is the modal category of subtypes of semi-presidentialism. Over 60% of countries with a semi-presidential constitution have this form of semi-presidentialism. So what was 40 years ago, at least in some respects, a constitutional leap in the dark, is now, Portugal is now part of the mainstream, part of the constitutional mainstream in some senses. I think it's important just to sort of reflect on that, because I think what one of the things that means is that we now know a lot more about semi-presidentialism now than we did 40 years ago. And Portugal is actually one of the cases that's allowed us to learn about what the effects of semi-presidentialism have been. So, you know, I think we're in a position now, which we weren't in a position at all 40 years ago, and probably not even 20 years ago, to at least start to say some things about semi-presidentialism with a degree of confidence. So I'm an academic and I'm happy to qualify everything, but I think we can say that the best way of thinking about semi-presidentialism is to think of it taxonomically. In other words, it's just a taxonomic category. Directly elected president with a prime minister and cabinet responsible to the legislature. If that's how we define semi-presidentialism, which is now the way in which most people define semi-presidentialism, then the absolute first observation to be made about semi-presidentialism is that it contains a whole variety of countries, countries that operate in just all sorts of different ways. So if we take that taxonomic definition of semi-presidentialism, then Russia is semi-presidential, Mozambique is semi-presidential, Slovenia is semi-presidential, Mongolia is semi-presidential, Poland is semi-presidential, Ireland, and so on. In other words, semi-presidentialism understood that way includes a set of countries which really have very little in common in one sense, apart from the fact that they share this very basic constitutional structure. But actually what that tells us, I think, is something quite important. In one sense, it tells us that the title of this presentation makes no sense. So the title of this presentation is Semi-Presidentialism and Governability. I actually think we should stop saying, we should stop even trying to imply that semi-presidentialism has certain effects for governability. Because there's so much variation within semi-presidentialism that I don't think we should expect semi-presidentialism to have a particular outcome of any sort. And in fact, in the paper that goes along with this, I actually go further than I say that if we understand semi-presidentialism this way, then if anybody were to say that this set of countries was associated with a particular outcome, I'd say they were just wrong, that the results are purely spurious. So in other words, I don't think we should talk of semi-presidentialism as having one independent effect on whatever that might be, whatever the focus of the inquiry is, never mind governability. To make sense of semi-presidentialism understood this way, we have to disaggregate it. We have to look at the within-regime variation. We have to start to talk about different types of semi-presidentialism. We have to make sense of the variation within semi-presidentialism. And then we have to see how that variation plays out in different contexts. And that's really what I'm going to focus on in the rest of the talk. So the first way in which that we, I think, need to disaggregate this notion of semi-presidentialism is by thinking about the variation in presidential power within the set of countries with a semi-presidential constitution. So in other words, we need to pass semi-presidentialism on the basis of presidential power. Now, the easiest way to do this, not necessarily the best way, but the easiest way to do this is the way in which I sort of hinted at earlier, which is to distinguish between two forms of semi-presidentialism, namely president-parliamentary form and the premier-presidential form. And if you're not aware of the difference between those two, and I didn't make up the terms, so don't blame me. I just had to live with them. Nonetheless, the difference between those two forms is that in a president-parliamentary form of semi-presidentialism, the president can dismiss the prime minister. So it's not just the legislature that can dismiss the prime minister, it's the president that can dismiss the prime minister too. So in effect, this distinguishes between two forms of semi-presidentialism on the basis of presidential power, on the basis of one presidential power, whether or not the president has the power to dismiss the prime minister or not. And we know from studies, including studies by very renowned Portuguese scholars, that president parliamentarism does have effects. It has effects on governability, precisely the topic that I'm talking about. So we know that president parliamentarism is associated with greater government instability. It makes sense in one sense. You know, if the president has the power to dismiss the prime minister and government and the legislature does, then it makes sense there's likely to be more government instability. But guess what? That's what we see. I think we know that, that president parliamentarism is more dangerous for young democracies than the other form of semi-presidentialism, premier presidentialism. In other words, presidential power, more presidential power is more dangerous for young democracies than a lower level of presidential power. So that's important. If we're sometimes asked to advise countries that are developing constitutions or are thinking about constitutional changes, that's a recommendation that we can make, I think, with some degree of confidence. And we also know that president parliamentarism, this form of the stronger form of a president, is more associated with conflict, with greater degree of conflict within the executive between the prime minister and cabinet. So those are three governability outcomes that we can talk about, that I think we know about, that relate to presidential power. But it's not about semi-presidentialism and governability, it's about breaking down semi-presidentialism and its effects on governability. But really, that's only talking about one presidential power. So what I was talking about, president parliamentarism and premier presidentialism, that's really only about whether or not the president has the power to dismiss the government or not. That's just one single power. There are other powers that might be consequential as well. So, for example, whether or not a president has the right to veto legislation or to send legislation back to parliament for a second reading, or whether a president has the right to send a bill to courts, that can affect governability too, because if you're in a government that knows that the president may send a bill back to you, then you might decide to rewrite that bill, or to write that bill rather, in advance in a different way than if the president doesn't have that power. And in some countries, in Slovenia, for example, in Croatia, presidents don't have the power to send a bill back to parliament or to send a bill to court. So just dismissing the prime minister or not may be one power. But veto power, returning power to returning a bill to the legislature is important too. And we also know that the power to dissolve the legislature is important. And that can be important not just in a French case to generate a majority that supports you. It can also be important to prevent your opponents from maybe doing things that they would have otherwise do. So, for example, I think the best case here is Taiwan. From 2000 to 2008, there was an opposition majority in the legislature in Taiwan, an opposition to the president, but the president had the power to dissolve the legislature if the opposition brought the government down. And the opposition basically calculated that it would prefer to cohabit with the president and be an opposition in parliament rather than risk a crisis and having a snap election called that it might lose. So the president's power to dissolve the legislature there had a really consequential effect on outcomes, but by sort of keeping a certain status quo rather than generating a new election. So we know these things matter. We know that presidential power matters, and presidential power varies in terms of individual powers from one semi-presidential country to another. But we can also bundle these powers together, so we don't just have to talk about whether a particular president has this power versus that power. We can code constitutions, we can try at least to come up with some sort of measure of the overall power of a president, and we know that if we do that, then again, presidents with more powers are likely to have a different effect than presidents with fewer powers. So in a recent study that I did, and I want to thank again some of the people who are sitting in this audience for helping me with this study, I did a survey of the extent to which there was a conflict between the president and the cabinet, comparing both semi-presidential regimes and parliamentary regimes in Europe. And what that study found was that semi-presidentialism versus parliamentarism didn't explain the significance, in terms of significance, the level of conflict between the president and the prime minister. What did explain the level of conflict was the degree of power, the overall degree of power that constitutionally a president had been given. So that makes sense in one sense, because there are some semi-presidential countries with completely figurehead presidents. There are some parliamentary countries where presidents can have a degree of power, a degree of influence. And there are also some other semi-presidential countries with very strong presidents. So that mix of semi-presidentialism meant that the regime itself was not a predictor of conflict. But what was a predictor, much better predictor, was the amount of power that a president had, whether it was in a parliamentary regime or a semi-presidential regime. So basically, let's not talk about semi-presidentialism and its single effect on governability. Let's disaggregate semi-presidentialism, talk about within regime variation, focusing on presidential power, and then see what its effects are. Having said that, though, presidential power is only really one aspect of what we need to be taking into consideration. We need to take into consideration the context in which those powers are exercised too. And here I think the French case is the typical case, the one that informs a lot of the thinking about semi-presidentialism. And I guess if I've tried to communicate, the first thing I want to communicate today is that we have to disaggregate semi-presidentialism. The second thing I want to communicate is that we have to try to stop thinking about France as the only case of semi-presidentialism. So let's, you know, try and dissociate ourselves from the French case when we're thinking about semi-presidentialism. Now, France is important. It's not to say that we shouldn't take consideration of it. France is important because France is a great illustration of how context can matter. So we know the situation that when the French president, leader of a presidential majority in an election, has a majority, that same majority in the legislature, then effectively you can get a super president. So many French presidents have been super presidents in terms of powers. But we also know that when the context changes, midterm elections say, and the legislative election returns a majority opposed to the president, that you can get a cut-price president, you can get a weak president, you get cohabitation. So France is a very good way of thinking about how context shapes the exercise of semi-presidential countries given a fixed level of presidential power. So it's presidential power plus context. And this context matters. Super presidents are likely to have impacts on governability. We know if you have a super president, then your outcomes are likely to be, or more likely to be, a function of the whim, the personality, the characteristics of that super president, which, you know, even outside the semi-presidential context at the moment is probably something that we're aware of might be quite challenging. But it's also the case that cohabitation can have problems for governability. It can cause presidential prime ministerial conflict. In countries like Romania, for example, and Poland, it's generated debates about who should attend the European Council meeting. Should it be the president or the prime minister? That creates tensions again within the executive. So we know that context, fixed level of presidential power here, but we know that context can change the exercise of that power, and that can have effects of governability. And I think that's typically, the French case is typically how we think about semi-presidentialism. But we should go a bit further. And we shouldn't just finish thinking about semi-presidentialism in terms of France. And I think Portugal, and again, I apologize for me for coming here to tell you this, but Portugal is a really nice case about telling us how Semi-presidentialism doesn't always have to operate in the French-style way. I mean, in Portugal, as you well know, the president is not typically the leader of the majority, never mind the leader of the majority in parliament, as it is in the French case. So, even if the president's party has a majority, the president's role has been relatively modest, certainly modest relative to the French case. So, you know, it's the same sort of system, same sort of context, but a different outcome. Similarly in cohabitation, you might even argue that Portuguese presidents become slightly more consequential during cohabitation, whereas in France, the president's influence goes right down. So context matters. It's not that the same context everywhere produces the same result. So that means that we shouldn't just talk about context and semi-presidentialism, because the context can shape results in different places differently. And if we go actually beyond France and Portugal, if we actually go just to the wider European Union, let's keep it to the 28 European Union member states, then 13 of those countries are semi-presidential, 13 of those have directly elected presidents, but only 3 of those 13 countries have presidents who attend European Council meetings, France, Romania, and Lithuania. So what that suggests about the other 10, including Portugal, is that the president is a much more modest figure, and in some cases, Slovenia, Iceland, Croatia, the president really is just a figurehead. So when we think about semi-presidentialism, we need to disaggregate, but when we think about semi-presidentialism, we need to stop thinking just about France, because France is actually quite an unusual case in Europe. France is not the modal case of semi-presidentialism. In fact, you know, the modal case of semi-presidential just in Europe is very different from the French case. There's no alternation in power between super-presidents and cohabitation. And, you know, to the extent that the role of the president is much more modest and in some cases really even a figurehead, then it doesn't necessarily create the same problems of governability that might emerge in the French case. So, sort of drawing to an end, how should we sort of think about semi-presidentialism if we try and think about presidential power and then try and place presidential power in context? I think we can probably say 3 things. The first is that semi-presidentialism makes presidents a political actor. No matter how powerful your president, the president will be a political actor. The president might be a super president at some times, or the president might just be a relatively modest president who intervenes constitutionally on certain occasions. But even if you have the most figurehead of presidents, you have a president who's still an actor, a president who still is directly elected, a president who has the authority, the legitimacy to say things, to actually create conflict, to create debate by making pronouncements. So I work in Ireland, and we have a directly elected president. Ireland, from my point of view, is semi-presidential, though don't tell some of my Irish colleagues that. They think it's parliamentary. They're wrong, but nonetheless. Ireland is semi-presidential. We recently, just a couple of weeks ago, a little less than that, however many days ago it was, had a controversy about our Irish presidency, because the president had made a statement on the death of Fidel Castro that was really quite relatively positive, or at least it accentuated the positive in terms of its assessment of Castro. And the immediate reaction was, you know, the president can't say that. This is not just substantively wrong in terms of the Cuban context, leave that whole debate aside. People were making comments about the presidency. In other words, even a president who has very, very few powers can still be a political actor just by virtue of words. So under semi-presidentialism, presidents are actors, but the level of actorness varies as a function of constitutional powers and context. That's, I think, the first thing we can say. The second thing I think we can say is that, you know, if you've got a directly elected president, if you've got a semi-presidential system, then the presidency itself will be, from time to time, the subject of debate. The president's role, the president's legitimacy will be questioned. And again, that will occur no matter how powerful your president is. So in the next year or so, or less than a year now, 6 months or so now, in the French context, we will be seeing all the different candidates saying things about what they think the role of the president should be. In other words, they are giving not just political recommendations, policy recommendations, they will be telling us what they think the role of the president should be. If you have a directly elected president, I think you're going to get that debate, you're going to get that role. And in fact, even in Ireland, which I just hinted at a minute ago there, there's been recently a debate about what the role of the president should be. So it's not just that presidents are actors. Because presidents are actors, it can call into the question the nature of the presidency. And I think we just have to live with that. We just have to put up with that. We can't have one without the other. But I suppose, finally, that doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. The way I've talked about semi-presidentialism and governability up to now, I've talked about super-presidents and cohabitation. They are generally presented quite negatively as being problems for semi-presidentialism, and quite often they are, depending upon the context. But there are other times when presidents, and talked about this, or Marina and I have written about this at various times, there are times when a president, even a weak president, even the most figurehead of president, can be an important part of a system of checks and balances. Again, maybe by using constitutional power, sending a bill to a court, whatever it might be, or again, maybe just through words by creating a debate. And, you know, if there's an intellectual consensus, if there's a political majority, if there are just issues that are not on the political agenda, presidents, even the weakest directly elected presidents, can sometimes play a really important role in setting the agenda, in raising issues that wouldn't otherwise be raised, and in that sense being placed in a system of separation of powers and checks and balances. But we can only think about these three things with regard to semi-presidentialism and presidencies if we start to stop talking about semi-presidentialism as a whole and start to instead disaggregate it into the different types of semi-presidentialism, the variation with semi-presidentialism, and see how those issues play out in all the different contexts in which we find ourselves. So thank you very much. Thank you.
Obrigado, señora presidenta. Quero agradecer, antes de comenzar, quero agradecer a profesora Marina Costa Lobo e tamén a Asamblea de la República pelo seu convite a estar aquí e facer esta presentación. Eu veño de Galicia, que é unha forma moi particular de ser portugués. O galego tamén é unha forma moi particular de falar portugués. E por iso vou falar en inglés. O sinto moito, mas, da outra forma, farei un exercicio de, como se dice en portugués, de destrozo da lingua, que o mellor non é o máis conveniente para estar aquí. I'm going to speak about, not about Spain, and I'm sorry, Ms. Meireles, I'm not going to speak about Spain, I'm going to speak about the European Union. I seldom speak about Spain in public conferences, it's something I gave up many years ago. And when Marina invited me to this conference, I thought on three different issues I could address under the notion of debates, actual current debates within European constitutionalism. One of them, which is very clear, I've been working on it, and probably will be the most convenient one for this conference, was about the transformation that the macroeconomic and fiscal governance is introducing in the continent. And I think if you look strictly in terms of constitutionalism, probably is the biggest challenge we have in the continent. Now that the crisis has kind of receded a little bit, we may think that this is not an important challenge, but in constitutional terms it's highly important. There has been, firstly, an exercise of petrification. I don't know whether you know the word, but it's transferring to primary legislation options that normally are reserved for secondary legislation, for democratic politics. And this has happened both at the national level and the European Union level. So now you have in constitutions and in the treaties certain options, political options, that before were freely disposed by a democratic process. And this is, second, complemented with a kind of a strong selection of ideological choices. So we have now in European constitutionalism a kind of making illegal, I wouldn't say illegal, but illegal, any form of Keynesianism. So this has become a common trait among countries, but also at the European Union level. The third element of this constitutionalism, which I think is dramatic, is the turn towards a strong agencialization, meaning that bodies which are not politically accountable or bodies which are not politically constructed, that would be the proper way to say it, like the Commission, the European Central Bank, but also the national level, the bodies in charge of controlling budgetary powers, have become increasingly empowered in this crisis. And linked to that, the fourth element here is in this constitutional crisis we have also this empowerment of Parliament. This is a very important topic. I'm sorry I'm not going to talk about that, and I would like to talk about that because I have realized that perhaps it would be the most suitable one here. The second one, which is really, in my opinion, is very deep, even though sitting in this western corner of the continent, perhaps we don't feel it, and that says something about, I don't know whether the quality of our democracy says something about us, is the crisis of the rule of law that we're experiencing in certain countries in the European Union. I'm speaking specifically about Hungary and Poland. What is going on in these countries is that those governments are using the majorities, democratic majorities, and let me emphasize that, they are using democratic majorities, because I want to come back to this using my presentation, to backslide, to cut the system of check and balances that protects the political system of those countries. Very clearly in Hungary, they have revised the constitution in a very majoritarian system, turning to giving all the powers to the national governments and leaving always powerless the judicial system. And Poland is basically following this trend also. And I'm going to spend on that, but there are other countries that can be following that trend. When you were mentioning before only the several forms of semi-presidency, probably you forget to mention that in the Czech Republic they have a huge dispute in the last decade about whether the president, at that moment was Václav Klaus, a not very democratic character, I would say, whether the president was entitled to go to the European Council or was the prime minister. There was a total constitutional dispute about the powers of the president in the Czech Republic, based on a very illiberal reading of the system of check and balances. So this is a very important topic also that affects European Union constitutionalism and affects also the model in which transitions were constructed in the eastern part of the continent, because basically this problem is derived from this moment of transition. So I'm not going to talk about this, which is a very important one. I'm going to concentrate in the third one, which perhaps is not the most important one. I don't know whether it's a sexy one, but at least it's kind of catchy now. The challenge that we have in constitutional terms is that there is a growing demand in certain areas of the continent, certain territories, to become independent at the same time, and this is the important point here to underline, at the same time that those territories become member states of the European Union. And let me be very clear on that. No territory in the European Union wants to be independent. It does imply not being a member of the European Union. That constructs the whole equation on which I am going to build my talk here. Now, this, of course, creates a transform environment in which independence is talk. Many of you will be familiar with the notion of self-determination in the past, in which colonial territories, colonial entities were considered legitimate to access independence because this represented a remedial mechanism, a process to resolve certain situations of domination which was perceived as illegitimate. This classical conception of self-determination and independence has been transformed in a very calculated one. The calculus now is not there is a situation of domination, even though rhetorically it has to be constructed to make it more palatable. But the argument here is we want to become independent because we are democratically decided so, and we want to do that because the context in which we do that, which is the European Union membership, represents a fair advantage for those territories. Both discourses in Catalonia and the in Catalonia and Scotland, but also in other regions like Flanders, emphasize precisely this very calculated view. The European Union, the argument of these actors is that the European Union should keep a neutral position. And why a neutral position? Because in reality, the European Union has nothing to do with independentist process, with secession processes, and merely its role there is to assert those territories once they become independent, sanctioning the democratic process. But I think there are strong arguments to argue for a non-neutral role for the European Union, which is the aspect I want to explore in my talk. The first, that this process of secession and territorial separation affects current member states. And current member states are protected within the European Union by a duty of loyalty towards each other, towards sincere cooperation. That means that in the case of critical situations, apparently at least, states should support each other in their respective demands. The second argument for which I believe that the European Union should have a more important role in this process is that those processes affect the institutional composition of the Union. This has been an argument very clearly voiced by Scottish and Catalan independents that say it doesn't matter, adding a new country wouldn't change much. It's not true. I don't know, many of you here, many of the students are fairly young, and you don't remember the debates about the ratification of the Lisbon Treaty, but one of the problems of the ratification of the Lisbon Treaty is that Ireland was going to be deprived of a commissioner, of a member of the Commission. And that created a mechanism for blocking the ratification of the treaty until the moment that Ireland was secured a commissioner permanently in the Commission. And that proves that any institutional change you introduce in the European Union affects deeply everyone. It's not a neutral fact. Not to say about things like what is going to be their position via the Schengen area, very relevant for Scotland, but could be also relevant for other cases too. What is going to be their position via European Monetary Union, the euro, should be obligated or not to be part of it, etc., etc. And the third reason by which I believe the European Union should have a more assertive role, a more clear role in this accession process is because adding a new actor always affects governance, changes the structure of preferences and relations between actors. And that's very clear what we have seen after 2004 in the enlargement of the European Union. Now, basically this condense says that the accession affects and alters third-party expectations also on accession. By that means that certainly could be conceived as slightly unfair that certain territories are given preeminence to access the European Union via others. And I wonder if we were, not to say Turkey perhaps, but I think in cases like Serbia, who is now negotiating an accession to the European Union, what is the feeling of being left behind because other territories get the recognition of statehood ahead of your expectations of becoming a legitimate member of the European Union? Now, our case is equal. I don't think so, and I think there are two criteria that allow to differentiate those cases, and I'm going to try to construct this typology very clear. The first difference between the cases is the nature of the constitutional challenge that is defined at the domestic level. In some cases, and you know that, there is an agreement or a consent on the process of independence. And this is important because traditional international law has recognized only remedial secessions, the right to unilateral secession, when there is a case of gross violation of human rights and individual freedoms. So to say that when this is a remedial secession. In parallel, this has been an emergence to the consideration of a certain right, democratic right to secession, but always on the basis of an agreement, right? So I don't know any literature that sustains, any serious literature that sustains that on the basis of unilateral decisions, a secession agreement will be acceptable. And the practice of the European Union regarding secession has been kind of uneven because the two most important cases here, Montenegro is not a case because of it has got a deep consensual element there and has been totally tutorized and administered by the European Union. In the two cases that can be used as comparisons, Kosovo and Crimea, the policy of the European Union has been totally different. In Crimea, the European Union unanimously agreed that was totally illegal and unacceptable. And hence, of course, Crimean secession from Ukraine has not been recognized. Whereas in the Kosovo case, which is the exception, there is a division among member states within the European Union. We can come back to revisit that, but it's basically the situation. The second element of difference is whether the constitutional position of the European Union, of the regional member state in relation to the European Union, is changing. And here I'm referring specifically to the case of the United Kingdom and withdrawal. Why could this be important? I think it has got importance that goes beyond merely political facts. It has also to do with the fact in which we conceive European integration. European integration has something to do about relinquishing sovereignty, being prepared to pool powers, being prepared to join decision-making, and withdrawal, in my understanding, represents a retreat into a very essentialist and exclusivist state of mind. Coming back to the very essences of sovereignty that the European Union somehow has nuanced in the past. And additionally, the European Union has played a very important role to limit pro-independence projects, because literature has established that probably this has been a mechanism, at least in the 80s and 90s, and perhaps we are now seeing a change into that, has been a mechanism to accommodate states with plural nationality, like Spain or Britain, and making them more palatable for those minorities which are nationally defined. Hence, those two elements define a kind of difference between the cases, and that creates this structure of constitutional scenarios that I want to discuss with you. You have here the possible cases along these two lines, cases in which secession has been agreed, consented, and cases in which there is a possible withdrawal of the original member state. And the cases that two of them are very real, which are the first cell there, which is with the letter A in Catalonia in 2014, and eventually will be the case of Flanders, at least has been presented by some scholars in this light. The second cell will be Scotland in 2014, also a real case. And the interesting cases that perhaps is worthwhile to discuss here are the cases what is going to happen with Scotland after the referendum in Britain in 2016. And there are two scenarios, and I will give perhaps some evidence why I think these scenarios are building up in the British political debate, and something may happen in the near future, or may not. But in any case, it's good to be... Now, if we come back to the... Remember, we are discussing this... this one here, cases A, right? So for this first type, which is a situation in which there is no consent and no withdrawal, the view from the European Union standing, and this is a very legal political argument, but certainly difficult to draw, is that unilateral secession is incompatible, totally incompatible with European Union law. This has been, to me, very clear, even though there are some disputes that have been arising, particularly by some Catalan pro-independence scholars. And the reasons for that is, first, there is an obligation in the treaties to respect territorial integrity of the states, very clearly said with this very language. By the way, this is a very Spanish language, and 3 minutes only. This is a very Spanish language because this provision was introduced by former President Aznar when the Lisbon Treaty was negotiated in the early 2000s. Second reason is the obligation of sincere loyal cooperation. That means that you have to take into account the situation of member states rather than the challenges put by territories. And the third argument, and I think is the most important, are the values recognized in Article 2. And this is a very powerful argument because normally the pretense to be recognized as an independent state is based on the assumption that it's a democratic decision. Now, the notion of democracy that is inherent to the European Union is not a simple one that reduces democracy only to majority decisions. Democracy, to be truly meaningful in constitutional states, has to be embedded in a set of values like rule of law, check and balances, fundamental rights, and so on and so forth. Let me just remember what I said at the very beginning. The government of Viktor Orban is basically limiting the action of the judges by appealing to constitutional, to democratic majority, is changing the constitution in a very authoritarian way by appealing to the democratic mandate, is eroding the position of the parliament by appealing to a democratic mandate, and so on and so forth. So appealing to majorities is not in itself a democratic argument. It's part of it, but it's not a democratic argument. At least it's embedded in the set of values of which we understand by democracy contemporary. Now, the second case, which was Scotland in 2014, and you know there was a referendum in Scotland, consent, agreement, but no withdrawal from the original member state. And here, this is a very interesting case because the whole dispute here was not whether it was acceptable or not independence, but rather in which terms Scotland will become a member of the European Union. And here the whole argument, and since I have some kind of time constraint, I'm going to develop it, but the whole argument is whether, surprisingly, whether we could bypass the treaties and make exception for accommodating Scotland in a quicker way. Something which I believe betrays somehow the own spirit of the European Union, but we can come back to that. Now, case D, and we are entering here into the speculation about the future. What can happen now in Britain after the Brexit referendum? And case D, consent and withdrawal, somehow nuances the scenario, the former scenario. And here the argument is, in legal terms, is not very different to the former one. What is interesting here is that this case represents some kind of mechanism to address, to redress the effects of Brexit. And in the way I have understood withdrawal, which is basically a contradiction with the values of the European Union, in this respect, possible independence of Scotland trying to redress the consequences of withdrawal becomes more acceptable from a kind of a moral point of view for the European Union, but not necessarily from the point of the view of the legality. So I don't think that Scotland will have an easier mechanism in legal terms, although politically probably the environment will be more palatable. And now it comes the interesting case, the case that probably will unfold, which is a situation in which there is no agreement for secession, but there is a withdrawal of a member state. So I call it a kind of nightmare scenario after 2016 or 2017. And here there are several factors we have to consider. The first of them, which is very well known, is that the result of the referendum on Brexit in Scotland was totally the opposite to the rest of the United Kingdom. And that's an important factor. But also very important is that the Scottish government tried to lobby before the referendum to introduce some kind of consortional mechanism for decision-making, meaning that there should be majorities in the different constituent parts of the United Kingdom, right? Meaning that Scotland, England, Wales and Northern Ireland should vote simultaneously in favour of one of the options to be taken seriously. The British government did not consider that, and it's probably one of the reasons why now we have this possible scenario in future. And the third important factor here is the position of the Scottish government negotiating Brexit, which so far is not very well defined to the point that the Scottish government is nowadays, today precisely, is in court trying to defend its position as an eventual negotiator of the condition of Brexit, because the Scottish government has already said very clearly something which is impossible, but they want, which is to remain in the single market whilst the United Kingdom leaves the European Union, which is totally incredible, because that would require to create a kind of border between Scotland and England. Otherwise, you cannot secure that the freedom of movement of goods and people stops in the border of Scotland and Britain. And there are, of course, other kind of questions, like what is going to happen with Northern Ireland and the border with Ireland, but that will add complication. Now, to add complexity, I have put in my, if you look at my, scheme, I have put here three small C cases, C1, C2, and C3, because here timing becomes very, very important. The succession of events could be totally determinant, and we have a situation in which secession could be triggered before the actual activation of Article 50. There is a lot of discussion about when is going the United Kingdom government to launch the application to leave the European Union. Theresa May has said that it will happen in March, but is not sure. What happens if it doesn't happen in March and the Scottish government decides to move ahead because they have evidence that Britain is not willing to negotiate the terms of withdrawal of Brexit with them? That creates a nightmare scenario, because United Kingdom remains formally at least a member of the European Union, and a territory of the that member state is willing to leave the European Union. And I think that will be unlikely, but technically will send us to the scenario A that I presented before. The second situation in temporal terms could happen that secession happens between the activation of Article 50 and the effective withdrawal from the European Union. There is a two-year period to withdraw from the European Union, two-year period to negotiate Brexit, and what could happen eventually is that the Scottish government decides to withdraw from the United Kingdom before that two-year period. That's a terrible nightmare situation. It's the worst situation possible. Why? Because the United Kingdom can decide to backtrack this decision, can decide to remain as a member of the European Union. Try to imagine that there is a change of government. That's not unlikely. could be a change of government that decides that the former government was totally wrong to accept the decision of the president, that they want to have a new referendum, or they want to have a vote in parliament with a new majority that supports remaining the European Union. And at the same time, already Scotland is making a move to leave the European Union. That creates a very difficult scenario to deal with. Again, it may be unlikely, but we have to consider that it may happen. And the third temporal scenario refers to triggering withdrawal triggering secession after withdrawal has happened. This again comes back to the proper CS scenario, and here we have a very difficult position, because this could be a situation in which a given territory wants to leave a country that once was a member of the European Union, because they perceive that their identity, their statehood, depends very much on being part of the European Union. Hence, it got some kind of pseudo-remedial character, in the sense of trying to recover some of the rights that they enjoy under the European Union situation. But on the other hand, and I want to be very clear on that, it is very doubtful that the European Union can sanction such a situation. So in this scenario of unilateral secession of Scotland without agreement with the United Kingdom, even in the case that the United Kingdom is outside the European Union, I think there is very little margin to accept Scotland as a member of the European Union. That, of course, in political terms, because there is always the argument that what is going to happen politically has nothing to do with legality. And this has happened many times in the European Union. This could happen also in this case. And this also speaks a little bit of the quality of our constitutional system. Now, to conclude, and I'm sorry for being so quick in my presentation, my main argument here is that facing secession, the European Union will rely definitely on consent agreement between parties. I don't think the European Union will accept unilateral secession as a matter of fact for accepting any member of the community itself. Consented secession might find a much better attitude, but doesn't mean that it will have an easier legal mechanism to enter in the European Union. And in the case of withdrawal, I think the attitude, if there is always a consented assumption, the attitude will be even more positive precisely because of this kind of pseudo-remedial character. I know I haven't dealt very much with that. I have in the written version of this material developed this concept, and I will be happy to discuss it with that. What I try to capture here is how this domestic developments create a challenge at the European Union in terms of the definition of the constitutional structure of the European Union. I will be happy to respond to your questions, and thank you very much for your attention.
Boa tarde a todos. Muito obrigada por estarem aqui. And good afternoon to the members of the panel. I'm going to speak in Portuguese. Este painel é sobre desafios constitucionais hoje. Portanto, é sobre desafios constitucionais. Foi constituído desta forma. E o paper que eu vos trago aqui é um paper muito exploratório que eu quis escrever sobre tipos de regime e a crise do euro. O que é o objetivo? A minha pergunta de partida é esta: em que medida é que as constituições, e em particular o tipo de regime vigente, influenciam de alguma forma a performance política dos países europeus durante a crise da zona euro? E esta questão surge de facto no seguimento de um post de blog que eu escrevi com o Robert Elgee aqui recentemente. Nós envolvemos-nos numa polémica no Twitter ou nas redes sociais sobre o papel que os presidentes nos regimes semipresidenciais estariam a ter na crise do euro. Houve um post que dizia que eles tinham um efeito muito negativo sobre a performance e sobre a qualidade da democracia em certos nos regimes semipresidenciais, e nós escrevemos um post indicando que os presidentes não teriam um efeito assim tão negativo. E esse post, que era um simples post, pôs-me a pensar um pouco sobre o impacto que o tipo de regime poderia ter. E porquê é que esta questão pode ser relevante? Bom, existe realmente um conjunto bastante alargado de estudos que tenta averiguar em que medida é que o semipresidencialismo é ou não benéfico para a democracia. E há várias opiniões de um lado e do outro. Por um lado, há quem argumente que o semipresidencialismo é mais inclusivo, e o Robert Elgee falou disso agora há pouco, e favorece a construção, obriga à construção de coligações, porque nós temos duas instituições que são eleitas de forma direta, por um lado o Presidente da República, por outro lado a Assembleia. Pode haver maiorias distintas, de cores políticas distintas, e portanto o semipresidencialismo inerentemente favorece a construção de compromissos e de coligações à partida. Por outro lado, essas mesmas características do semipresidencialismo também favorecem a existência do que se chama o executivo dividido, ou da coabitação, que quando há oposição entre esses dois órgãos, pode fragilizar o governo. Portanto, há aqui duas perspectivas sobre o funcionamento do semipresidencialismo, e eu achei que era interessante explorar como é que estes tipos de regime têm-se comportado neste período tão difícil da austeridade e da crise da zona euro que se tem vivido na última... Não chegamos a uma década, mas aproximamos disso. E isto insere-se num grande debate a que o Robert Elgee já fez muita referência sobre vantagens e desvantagens de vários tipos de regime. Eu salientei aí um conjunto de publicações, mas não é de todo exaustivo, de autores que se têm colocado como grandes entusiastas do semipresidencialismo, como o Pasquino, o próprio a Sophie Mostrup, a L.G. McManaman, e outros muito mais críticos, como o Juan Linz ou Cindy Scates. E achei que era interessante olhar para o caso dos semipresidencialismos, aliás, dos regimes na União Europeia, porque nós estamos perante um conjunto de regimes que, apesar de tudo, têm características socioeconómicas relativamente parecidas. Ou seja, quando nós fazemos análises comparativas, temos que controlar uma série de fatores, e muitas vezes quando se faz análises sobre tipos de regime, que inclui presidencialismos, parlamentarismos, semipresidencialismos, estamos a falar de países extremamente diversos, do ponto de vista das características socioeconómicas, e aqui temos um grupo bastante mais homogéneo e que permite, de alguma forma, olhar para estas diferenças de regime, embora, como já iremos ver, eu concordo que existem grande variabilidade dentro dos tipos de regime. Portanto, aqui a apresentação que eu iria fazer tem esta estrutura. Em primeiro lugar, caracterizar muito brevemente os tipos de regime político que existem na União Europeia hoje, olhar para a literatura, para os estudos, e o que é que eles dizem sobre a relação que existe entre estes tipos de regime e a sua durabilidade, qualidade e performance das democracias. E depois mostrar-vos alguns indicadores de qualidade da democracia na Europa, antes e depois de 2008, bem como de performance das democracias, nomeadamente escolhi estes indicadores: a durabilidade dos governos, a existência ou não de governos minoritários, o grau de fragmentação do sistema partidário e a existência ou não de governos de coligação. Escolhi estes fatores porquê? Porque estes fatores têm sido muitas vezes utilizados como indicadores em outros estudos, indicadores de governabilidade, no sentido em que quanto maior estabilidade governativa houver, melhor poderá ser a performance das democracias. Isto são, obviamente, que depois isto teria que ser olhado com mais detalhe, mas são indicadores sobre alguma performance das democracias. E então, temos essencialmente dois tipos de regime na União Europeia, o parlamentarismo e o semipresidencialismo. O parlamentarismo é um regime que vai evoluindo de forma incremental, que é dominante no Noroeste Europeu, sendo que o exemplo, o protótipo do parlamentarismo é obviamente o Reino Unido, e é um modelo hierárquico. É um modelo em que nós temos um executivo que está formalmente dependente do poder legislativo. Não há poder dual, é um poder, o poder está com o legislativo e o executivo depende deste poder. Obviamente que depois existe o segredo da eficiência da Constituição que faz com que seja o executivo, por causa das maiorias partidárias, que possa dominar o legislativo, mas formalmente no regime parlamentar é o poder legislativo o principal poder e o executivo está dependente dele sempre. Já o outro modelo tipo europeu é o semipresidencialismo. E tal como o Robert Elge explicou, a Quinta República Francesa e a Constituição de 1958 é fundamental e é o protótipo desse modelo semipresidencial. Embora a Primeira República Semipresidencial tenha sido a de Weimar, mas isso tem sido esquecido, ou pelo menos não é costume lembrar. Houve um grande debate entre académicos sobre como definir o semipresidencialismo. O de Verger, eu coloquei essa referência ao artigo de 1980, porque ele de facto foi a primeira pessoa a avançar com uma definição baseada no que sabia sobre a Quinta República Francesa do que era o semipresidencialismo, nomeadamente um presidente eleito de forma direta, com poderes consideráveis e que coabitava e dividia poder executivo com um primeiro-ministro que, por sua vez, estava dependente da Assembleia, do poder parlamentar. Ora, isto colocou sempre a questão do que eram poderes presidenciais consideráveis. Houve um grande debate em torno disso, até que o Robert Elge avançou com uma simplificação para a definição. E a partir daí, e que é uma definição que nos interessa porque ela é constitucional. Para definir um regime como semipresidencial, basta que exista um presidente eleito de forma direta e que exista também um primeiro-ministro que é formalmente dependente do Parlamento. Isto faz com que o semipresidencialismo combine um modelo de transação, isto é, existem dois poderes autónomos, é o presidente e o poder legislativo, com um modelo hierárquico, que é a forma como o governo e o primeiro-ministro estão dependentes também eles do Parlamento, da Assembleia. Aqui temos, tendo em conta estas definições, os tipos de regime que existem na Europa. E vemos que temos um conjunto, portanto, basicamente temos um conjunto de países parlamentares e outros semipresidenciais, sendo o Chipre uma exceção, que optou por um modelo presidencial e ele não está incluído nesta análise. Os países que têm uma estrelinha ao lado são aqueles que se tornaram membros da Zona Euro a partir de pelo menos 2002. Uns entraram mais tarde. Mas temos aqui nos parlamentos, nos regimes parlamentares, dois tipos. Aqueles em que são monarquias constitucionais e os que são repúblicas parlamentares. E se olharmos para os grupos dessa forma, vemos que há mais países semipresidenciais do que monarquias parlamentares ou do que repúblicas parlamentares. Portanto, nesta tipologia, os semipresidencialismos são até maioritários na União Europeia hoje. Então, o que é que se tem dito, o que é que se tem avançado sobre tipos de regime e performance democrática? Em primeiro lugar, este tipo de estudos preocupou-se muito em tentar relacionar a escolha de modelo constitucional com a sobrevivência da democracia. Essa era a principal questão. Para democracias jovens, para novas democracias, em que medida é que escolher o presidencialismo ou escolher o semipresidencialismo era por si só um fator que poderia contribuir para a queda da democracia. E esta intervenção do Robert Elge agora anteriormente foi muito importante porque, de facto, começou-se a gerar um debate que mostrou que, mais do que o tipo de regime em si, interessava saber os poderes presidenciais. E eram os poderes presidenciais que eram mais preditores da durabilidade dos regimes políticos e da sobrevivência das democracias. E, portanto, há aí uma grande diferença que se faz entre President Parliamentary e Premier Presidential Regimes. Muito bem. Com o passar do tempo, foi-se olhando para a performance democrática mais concretamente e, mais uma vez, olhar para também a ressaltar a questão dos poderes presidenciais. E eu gostaria só de salientar um estudo que foi publicado em 2009, em que o Sheibubi, José António Sheibubi e Svetlana Chernik fazem uma comparação entre regimes Premier Presidential e Parliamentary, que é sobretudo aquilo que nos interessa, porque os regimes europeus, aqueles semipresidencialismos que eu vos mostrei, são essencialmente Premier Presidential e, portanto, o que interessa é comparar estes dois tipos de regime. E o que os estudos anteriores mostravam era que havia diferenças, sobretudo, entre parlamentares e os President Parliamentary, mas falava-se muito menos sobre Premier Presidential e Parliamentary, e ficava-se na dúvida se eles, de facto, seriam tão realmente muito semelhantes. O que estes autores assinalam é que, nos semipresidencialismos, os governos tendem a ter menor duração do que os parlamentarismos, maior fragmentação parlamentar, maior prevalência de regimes maioritários, mas depois eles desconstroem estas diferenças com as análises que fazem e dizem que a melhor performance, suposta performance dos regimes parlamentares, fica a dever-se exclusivamente ao facto de estes integrarem os regimes first past the post com o sistema eleitoral como o típico britânico, e são esses governos maioritários que dão a suposta melhor performance ao regime parlamentar, isto é, fica-se a dever mais ao sistema eleitoral do que propriamente ao tipo de regime. Ok. Então, o que é que eu vos venho aqui mostrar para explorar um pouco aquela ideia de se é verdade que a crise terá tido algum impacto na performance dos diferentes tipos de regime que nós temos na União Europeia? Temos 15 regimes parlamentares e 12 regimes Premier Presidential, semipresidenciais. E aquilo que fizemos é uma base de dados que vai de 1990 a 2016, com indicadores, por um lado, de qualidade da democracia, nomeadamente da Freedom House. Estes indicadores da Freedom House variam entre 1 e 7, sendo que 1 é o valor mais alto em termos de qualidade democrática e 7 o mais baixo. E depois indicadores da Polity Four, que são indicadores em que acima de 6 estamos com valores mais positivos de democracia, portanto é ao contrário. E depois um conjunto de indicadores sobre performance democrática, nomeadamente o número efetivo de partidos eleitorais e parlamentares, que dá uma indicação da fragmentação que existe no Parlamento, o grau de desproporcionalidade, que tem a ver com o grau de proporcionalidade do sistema eleitoral, a frequência de mudança de governo e a frequência de mudança do primeiro-ministro, a percentagem de assentos controlados pelo maior partido, a percentagem de governos maioritários e a frequência de tempo em que existe um governo de coligação. Porquê é que eu achei que isto era importante verificar? Muitas vezes, aquelas pessoas que estudam semipresidencialismo acham que só vale a pena pensar na influência que o tipo de regime pode ter no funcionamento democrático para as jovens democracias ou para democracias menos consolidadas, e que a União Europeia e a Europa Ocidental seriam menos sensíveis ao efeito do tipo de regime. Mas a minha questão é, tendo em conta esta turbulência tão grande do ponto de vista da crise económica que se tem vivido, talvez haja aqui um espaço para o tipo de regime ter tido um impacto. Mas não quer dizer que eu esteja à procura necessariamente de um efeito negativo do semipresidencialismo, porque nós sabemos que o tipo de semipresidencialismo que existe na União Europeia é sobretudo um Premier Presidentialism. Portanto, também há aqui um interesse na comparação entre parlamentarismo e o tipo de semipresidencialismo que é o melhor, que já foi visto que é o melhor para a performance democrática. Ok. Então, eu tenho aqui alguns dados, algumas tabelas que são muito básicas e descritivas e que exploram os dados que nós recolhemos, eu e o Luís Cabrita, sobre a performance política dos regimes parlamentares. E o que eu vos queria mostrar, eu não sei se consigo. Portanto, esta coluna, em primeiro lugar, esta coluna aqui. Portanto, o que esta tabela faz é mostrar para o período de 1990-2016 o conjunto dos dados. E aqui o que interessa são as médias. Ah, e também as correlações que vocês não veem porque está fora do... Mas eu digo-vos. E o que é que este quadro mostra? Esta é uma primeira comparação muito básica, não é? Entre as médias de um conjunto de países e de outro. E nós vemos que a média da qualidade da democracia nos parlamentares é mais elevada do que nos semipresidenciais. Não se esqueçam que os valores para a Freedom House, quanto mais elevados, mais baixa a qualidade da democracia. O Polity Four é ao contrário. No caso, isto sempre para 90-2016, no caso dos outros indicadores, que são os indicadores mais de performance democrática, nós vemos curiosamente que o número efetivo de partidos parlamentares é superior nos regimes parlamentares do que nos semipresidenciais. E que a duração dos governos é menor nos regimes parlamentares, para o conjunto do período, do que nos regimes semipresidenciais. No caso do valor das coligações, da percentagem de tempo em coligação, é mais elevado nos semipresidencialismos do que nos parlamentarismos. Portanto, aqui o semipresidencialismo está a exibir diferenças que são significativas do ponto de vista das correlações, menos qualidade da democracia e maior percentagem de tempo de governos, de coligação, e também menor percentagem do partido maior. É claro que no período de 1990-2016 nós temos um conjunto de democracias que são semipresidenciais, que são muito mais jovens do que no conjunto dos regimes parlamentares em que existem democracias muito consolidadas e, portanto, aqui pode ser, obviamente, um efeito da juventude da democracia que leva a esta menor qualidade. Portanto, o que esta tabela seguinte faz, nesta tabela seguinte o que nós fizemos foi simplesmente distinguir entre o período de 1990-2008 e a última década, que não chega a ser uma década, a partir do início da crise da zona euro, e ver como é que estes regimes estão a evoluir desse ponto de vista. E o que é interessante aqui verificar é que os semipresidencialismos, que para o conjunto do período têm uma qualidade da democracia inferior, tornam-se... melhoram a qualidade da sua democracia nesta última década. Portanto, há aqui um processo de catching up destes regimes semipresidenciais, que são premier presidential, em relação aos regimes parlamentares. E, do ponto de vista da performance política, antes e depois de 2008, não há nenhuma diferença que seja significativa entre parlamentarismos e semipresidencialismos. Portanto, a trajetória dos regimes antes e depois de 2008, é curioso que nós vemos que os regimes parlamentares exibem até uma pequena tendência para menos qualidade da democracia, os semipresidenciais maior qualidade da democracia, e não há diferenças significativas na performance. Esta tabela, o que é que mostra? Com os mesmos dados, isolámos apenas aqueles países que integram a zona euro, porque pode-se colocar uma questão de que não interessa tanto comparar todos estes casos, mas apenas aqueles que, fazendo parte da moeda única, podem ter sofrido com mais intensidade os efeitos da crise da zona euro a partir de 2008. Então, o que é que estes dados nos mostram? Os regimes semipresidenciais que estão na zona euro são as democracias mais consolidadas e mais antigas, e desse ponto de vista até a qualidade da democracia que existe é superior nos regimes semipresidenciais do que nos parlamentares, considerando apenas os países que estão na zona euro. E vemos que não, em termos dos indicadores da performance democrática, não há diferenças significativas em termos, por exemplo, de mudança de governo ou mudança de primeiro-ministro, tempo, instabilidade governativa a nível de governo ou de primeiro-ministro. Onde sim há bastante diferença é que tem havido uma maior fragmentação a partir de 2009, uma maior fragmentação entre os regimes semipresidenciais, muito mais fragmentação, o número efetivo de partidos parlamentares aumentou significativamente e também os partidos eleitorais, o que é interessante. Portanto, isto é só repetir aquilo que eu já disse, nos países da zona euro temos regimes semipresidenciais com valores máximos da qualidade da democracia. Entre as democracias parlamentares, já tínhamos visto isso antes, vemos aqui uma mesma ligeira tendência para uma deterioração da qualidade da democracia, mas, curiosamente, regimes semipresidenciais com maior fragmentação dos sistemas partidários. Por último, aqui o que é que se apresenta? A correlação, para ver se há diferenças, considerando o conjunto de países que todos da União Europeia de 2008 a 2016 e apenas os países da Eurozona, em que, se é que eles se distinguem em alguma coisa. E a única coisa que realmente os distingue é o tal indicador da qualidade da democracia do Freedom House Index, sendo que há uma aproximação dos regimes semipresidenciais à média, que era superior e que está um pouco em deterioração, dos regimes parlamentares. Portanto, não verificamos diferenças significativas em nível destes indicadores de governabilidade entre estes regimes semipresidenciais, que são tendencialmente Premier Presidential, e os parlamentares aqui apresentados, especialmente quando olhamos para o caso dos países da zona euro. E estou a terminar. Portanto, se olharmos para o conjunto do período 1990 a 2016, o semipresidencialismo exibe, de facto, diferenças significativas em termos de qualidade da democracia e a percentagem de tempo de governos de coligação. Isso é possivelmente, e já foi demonstrado por outros autores, efeito da juventude das democracias semipresidenciais incluídas no conjunto do grupo. Mas há aqui uma trajetória positiva, e há uma trajetória positiva também nos últimos 8 anos. Não há diferenças significativas em termos destes indicadores de performance, seja entre todos os países ou nos países da zona euro, que possam distinguir entre estes tipos de regime. O que é curioso e de facto está lá nos dados que nós recolhemos, é que entre os regimes semipresidenciais tem havido um aumento significativo de fragmentação partidária, e uma consequente redução da percentagem obtida pelo maior partido parlamentar, obviamente, só que esse aumento na fragmentação partidária possivelmente não estará relacionado com o tipo de regime, mas sobretudo, eventualmente, com o sistema eleitoral e a sua proporcionalidade. Mas, de qualquer forma, há uma mudança aí, sem ter havido mudanças no sistema eleitoral. Portanto, o que estes indicadores revelam é uma eventual consolidação de indicadores que eram menos positivos de governabilidade nos regimes semipresidenciais, numa melhoria, num quadro que nos sugere resultados relativamente positivos para o semipresidencialismo na Europa e de que Portugal faz parte. Obrigada.
Quer colocar? Ok. Temos ainda algum tempo antes de finalizar este painel, entre 15 a 20 minutos, pelo que eu apelo aos assistentes, se querem colocar questões ou eventualmente interpelar e colocar outros pontos de vista em relação àqueles que foram ditos, sobre 3 questões diversas de constitucionalismo. Se não, é? Não. Se não, eu poderei colocar uma pergunta e avançava com uma pergunta. Ah, ok. Então, por favor.
Obrigado. All very, very interesting presentations. I guess I would just like to ask one general question, which is, with the fascinating presentation on semi-presidentialism and the two presentations on semi-presidentialism and the institutional factors involved, my methodological question has to do with ways of disentangling the impact of the strict institutional distinction and other factors that may, to some extent, be associated with it, may correlate with it, particularly given the fact that semi-presidentialism has increased so much as the number of new democracies has accumulated. So I think it's a fascinating question, but it just strikes me there's a big methodological kind of challenge there, and I wonder if there's anything you can say about that. I don't know, have any suggestions, but I just have the question. Thank you. Yeah. To Marina and Robert.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I think your question is in line with my presentation in the sense that I think for too long, I actually was reading a paper the other day which stated that we had basically agreed what semi-presidentialism was in about 2005. By that time, we pretty much stopped debating what it is, and I cheered, "Ray, that's a decade since we've stopped asking what this thing is." But one of the things I don't think we have stopped doing is extrapolating from very small n. And so there's a lot of work on semi-presidentialism, which is fed into even work that goes into NGOs like International IDEA, the sort of the constitution making NGOs, which is based on a very, very small n, and I'm just not sure how reliable it is. So I think actually one of the things that we need to do is to do many more studies that are basically multivariate studies of the effects of semi-presidentialism. I think at the moment those are starting. There's a really great paper in EJPR just this year by Jorge Fernandez and Pedro Magalhães on basically, a really good study of semi-presidentialism. So I actually think we need more of those sorts of studies, and then we'd be able to draw more reliable conclusions. Though, I guess where I was going in my presentation was that I think in the end it won't be the regime which is the explanatory variable of interest. It'll be presidential power which is the explanatory variable of interest.
Well, thank you, Robert, for your question. I mean, I agree with what Robert was saying. I think that there have been some studies that are multivariate and that are very interesting and that show some of the things that are part of the state of the art and that actually have advanced the field quite a lot. I don't think that this is really an exploratory chapter in the sense that if you don't have any correlation, you might as well not have to worry about multivariate analysis, right? And I think that what this paper shows is that the tendency is that it doesn't really seem to make that much of a difference in the EU countries what type of regime you have, and that is in accordance to several publications that have, when you compare parliamentary with premier presidential, so very specific types of regime. I'm not talking generally about semi-presidentialism versus parliamentarism, because there we've seen it could be problematic if these regimes are president parliamentary. So, but definitely this is, there should be a formal, there are ways to do it, and hopefully it could be done. But in any case, what I found was most interesting about this was the lack of institutional consequences that the last decade seems to have had on most of these indicators, The data just don't show any deterioration to a significant extent that could be explained by type of regime, which to me was surprising, but in a sense, positive. Thanks.
I wanted to make a question to Marina. It's kind of a methodological question. Have you controlled at all by... I could not follow the data you were presenting, so perhaps I don't have the data to do the proper question, but the question would be, if you are focusing in the period between 2008 and 2016, one of the things that comes to my mind is that you need to control for the structural position of those countries, whether they are creditors or debtors. If you are looking at the period between 2008 and 2016, you need to control, perhaps it would be nice to control by the structural position of those countries, whether they are creditors or debtors, because I didn't got all the data, so perhaps I'm going to say something which is wrong, but if I remember correctly, you classify Portugal as semi-presidential, Cyprus as presidential, is that correct? Mm-hmm. And then the others are parliamentarians. The others who are under programs. So if there is some relation between the quality... So you think there's no relation between the kind of... erosion provoked by the economic crisis and the locus, the geographical locus of concession, that and there is a kind of relationship between the model of a political system they had. Because more of the countries, even though you have Ireland and Portugal, the others will be parliamentary systems. And you include also in that category countries that were having difficulties, say like Italy or Malta. Then the sample of parliamentary regimes under strain increases.
Thank you for your question. It's the relationship between economic change and democratic performance is kind of the rationale for the paper. It's an interest to see whether, in fact, you could detect in the indicators. For the period that we are selecting, a significant change, and the little change that exists that we can detect is especially on the side of the parliamentary regimes rather than on the semi-presidential regimes, which is interesting, considering what we know about the literature on semi-presidentialism, but not on premier presidentialism. So I think that this is really... It's very descriptive, it's not really analytical, but absolutely it would be an important factor to consider, and we have collected the data on economic indicators as well, so eventually it would be nice to be able to formalize that. Thanks.
So, just departing from the intervention of Professor Carlos Clos, I would like to address a question that probably Professor Robert Elgi would be able to answer. It's not a very legal question. It's more basically what you think, and that will not be a case of secession. It might be a case of secession, but also of possible... Do you think that it might be an evolution in terms of the Ulster of a possible reunification with Ireland as a consequence of a Brexit, in the sense that imagine that at the very end the outcome is a kind of hard Brexit where Britain will be completely not able to benefit from access to the single market, and if that might possibly, although if I'm correct, the results of the Brexit referendum in the Ulster were not in favour, were the out that won. But you think that most, in political terms, once that the economic consequences of possibly a hard Brexit will start to be, let's say, very clear to the residents in the Ulster, that might be any developments that could change the constitutional status of that part of the UK?
addressed to him, but I will try to say something. I haven't studied in detail the case of Northern Ireland, but apparently the government of Northern Ireland is demanding a position in the a place in the negotiation on withdrawal, and the British government, similar to Scotland, is a kind of midway. It's not totally in favor of that. It's kind of reluctant. There has been some indication and some, perhaps you know better than me this question, but there has been some indication by some political parties in Northern Ireland that if Brexit happens in a very hard way, the hard Brexit, they may call for a reunification referendum with the rest of the island. The problem here is even more complicated because that requires also the consent of the other party, which is the Republic of Ireland, that of course has to say something, about that. My prognosis is that the situation, I couldn't say specifically what's going to happen, but certainly the situation doesn't look very easy to resolve to me, because in Northern Ireland, even without taking into account the political dimension, the practical dimension of Brexit is terrible, because you have to close the border. And closing the border has deep implications on the Holy Friday, is that the name? The Good Friday Agreement. It has got deep implications. So I wouldn't speculate how far these implications could go, but certainly are there. So even without putting on the table the question of secession, Brexit has got terrible, in the sense of very deep implications in the case of Northern Ireland. And I don't know whether they're engaging already with the Irish government. The last declaration yesterday, I think, was the Irish Prime Minister, was again repeating that Britain could not have an easy ride on the four freedoms of the market, that we're not prepared to consent a hard Brexit. And that, for me, is a kind of indication, but you don't know what is going on behind closed doors, but it's a kind of indication that perhaps the talks between the two governments have not advanced very much. And I think that's totally crucial for the United Kingdom, absolutely crucial that they consult the Irish government in that respect. But again, I'm not an expert on that, and perhaps I'm saying anything that Roger could qualify a lot and say that are totally wrong.
Well, I think it's fair to say that I am way less qualified than you are to say anything about this. I just happen to live there, so, I mean, that doesn't make me qualified to speak about the country, really. I mean, still, why not? I think I'd make two points. One is that everything is up in the air. It's just, we don't know what's going to happen. Who knows what the scenarios are going to play out? You know, we had the analysis of what might happen there in Scotland had a whole bunch of scenarios quite, you know, presciently. We just don't know. It is two things within that. One is that it is entirely possible that the British government could take its eye off the Northern Ireland issue or the Irish issue because it's got bigger issues to deal with. And so that could be problematic. And the second thing with regard to that is also that, you know, no matter how much peace there's been over a period of time, you know, conflict could reemerge. So in the everything is up in the air aspect of the answer to the question, really anything could occur, including going back to conflict. And if there are, you know, big changes, then that conflict is obviously more likely to come back into the scene. Having said that, and this is the second point I was going to make, was that, you know, there are some very entrenched institutions now, not least the Good Friday Agreement, and there are some very entrenched ways of working which were simply not present before. So therefore, one of the things that's, I guess, happened to the extent that anything has happened is that there's been a continuity. So that suggests more continuity than change, at least in the short term, but that really is a short term. Beyond that, who knows?
Eu não sei se mais alguém quer colocar alguma questão. Eu aproveitava para colocar uma à Marina, que tem a ver com a situação e com o regime em Portugal. Porque depois da formação desta solução governativa em Portugal, de governo, não é? Em que os partidos menos votados se uniram para formar ou para dar posse a um governo de um deles. Houve quem dissesse que estamos numa, que o regime assumiu uma forma, que o nosso semipresidencialismo assumiu uma forma parlamentarista, e até quem diga que existe uma deriva parlamentarista. Eu gostava de saber se tu estás de acordo com isso ou não.
Obrigada, Luísa. Eu não estou de acordo com essa avaliação, e eu também li isso quando isso aconteceu, e não me parece que essa seja uma visão correta, uma leitura correta do semipresidencialismo em Portugal. Porque o semipresidencialismo em Portugal, no semipresidencialismo em Portugal, o presidente continua com poderes, os poderes que tem. O governo, tal como nós estávamos a conversar à hora do almoço, é um governo minoritário, e os governos minoritários têm sempre um pouco mais de necessidade do apoio presidencial do que os governos maioritários monopartidários. E, portanto, o que caracteriza esta situação é que o governo, no meu entender, é fraco. É fraco, eu até já escrevi isso, o governo é fraco porque é minoritário, é fraco porque tem uma coligação de incidência parlamentar nova, que é difícil no dia-a-dia, que existem um conjunto de pontos que os separam, nomeadamente União Europeia, etc., mas também outras questões até internas, e, portanto, em situações em que o governo é fraco, o presidente normalmente assume um papel maior. O que se está a passar neste momento é que o presidente, existe uma cooperação estratégica entre o presidente e o primeiro-ministro. E essa cooperação estratégica ilude, está a iludir a força do presidente. Porque o presidente está de acordo com aquilo que o governo faz e não está a fazer oposição ao governo. E, portanto, a fraqueza do governo, que é uma fraqueza real, não está a ser posta em evidência, porque não convém ao presidente neste momento fazer isso, mas está a acumular crédito para, em qualquer momento que isso lhe possa interessar, poder intervir com alguma força. E isso, para mim, é a leitura que eu faço deste momento, que é bastante único do ponto de vista do sistema político. E não considero que haja uma parlamentarização. Há uma parlamentarização em que medida? E apenas nessa. Na medida em que o governo, sendo minoritário, tem que negociar no Parlamento medidas importantes. E aí distingue-se de um governo monopartidário, de maioria absoluta, certamente, que não precisa de ir ao Parlamento encontrar maiorias e pode contar com elas, porque existe sempre a disciplina partidária em Portugal. E é aí que faz a diferença. Mas não com o poder do Presidente. Para mim. Obrigada.
Muito obrigada, Marina, por esta resposta. Não sei se existe alguma outra questão, se não são 5 horas, e eu dava por encerrada este painel. Agora estou a ver.
Da nossa conferência de hoje, última sessão, porque nós tínhamos agendado uma mesa redonda depois disto, mas ela teve de ser cancelada devido a compromissos dos deputados de última hora, nomeadamente na sessão plenária, e portanto temos esta apresentação do professor Sérgio Fabrini. Welcome, professor Sérgio Fabrini.
E esta apresentação é do professor Sérgio Fabrini, que é diretor do Centro de Governação do Luís Guido Carli, que é em Roma, no Instituto Universitário em Roma. E o professor Sérgio Fabrini também é Visiting Professor na Universidade de Berkeley, nos Estados Unidos. E tem estudado a fundo os regimes democráticos, nomeadamente o caso dos Estados Unidos, o presidencialismo, mas também, mais recentemente, a União Europeia. Tem um livro publicado que se chama Which European Union? E é um pouco os resultados, os findings desse livro que ele vem partilhar connosco hoje. Antes de passar a palavra ao professor Sérgio Fabrini, eu queria apenas dizer que a forma de acabar esta conferência é algo prospectiva, ou seja, nós reunimos aqui hoje para debater a Constituição Portuguesa, que faz 40 anos em 2016, no contexto da terceira vaga da democratização. Mas eu, enquanto coordenadora científica desta conferência, pretendi, por um lado, analisar ou revisitar as condições genéticas desta nossa Constituição, porque nós sabemos que as condições genéticas são determinantes para o funcionamento das instituições todo ao longo da sua vida. Portanto, um olhar retrospectivo, mas também quis trazer aqui oradores que tivessem um olhar prospectivo sobre o que é o futuro das constituições europeias. E, em particular, penso que não se pode pensar hoje o sistema político sem olhar para a União Europeia. E é por isso que eu pensei no professor Fabrini para fechar com chave de ouro esta conferência, para nos fazer aqui um keynote speech sobre o futuro das constituições na nova Europa. Thank you very much, Professor.
It's a pleasure to be in such a nice city again. What I will try to do is to discuss about the constitutional issue concerning the European Union. Today we have discussed about the constitutional issue concerning the member state of the European Union, the national state. I would move to the supranational level, and I would try to suggest a path for understanding the crisis of the European Union and how to come out from that crisis. So my roadmap will be first, I give you my presentation of my research question, what I call the constitutional narrative, the competition between different constitutional narratives in the European Union. And then I will discuss the three main perspectives that we have within the European Union and their constitutional implication. Finally, I will arrive to my proposal about the need of differentiating constitutionally the European Union and to give a political constitution to the Eurozone area. But let me start from the introduction. Which constitutional narrative has accompanied the European Union? The constitutional narrative of the EU, which means what the EU should be, is dependent on the interpretation of the EU nature, what the EU is. And frequently there is a kind of overlapping between what the EU is and what the EU should be. I try to keep the two separated. Although the EU self-defined itself in the Lisbon Treaty is an example of that as a union of states, what do we mean and what is meant for union of states is not univocal. In my research, in my book, I try to show that there are different perspectives on the European Union, on what the EU is and what the EU should be. Those perspectives have led to interstate compromises on which the EU has been built from Maastricht in 1992 to Lisbon Treaty in 2009. And also this fact that I interpret the EU as an institution, as an organization, structured and organized on interstate compromise stress my approach, which is an approach very different from the classical neo-functional approach, but also from the classical intergovernmental approach. I look to the EU as a union of states, and so states matter to a certain extent even more than the bureaucracy or technocracy operating in Brussels. So these interstate compromises has created differentiated policy regime. And Maastricht even created a different separate pillar. In Lisbon, with the Lisbon Treaty, those pillars were abolished, but the differentiated decision-making method were preserved. But those differentiation were kept under a unitary legal order, the legal order represented by the Lisbon Treaty. So each of these perspectives has elaborated, pursued his own specific answer to the question, how can we define the constitutional identity of the European Union? And how do we need to move in that direction to legitimize the European Union? So I identify three different perspectives of the European, within the European Union. In some way, I would say my argument is that the European Union is constituted of different unions. We take for granted as a unitary project, but within the European Union there are different perspectives, different views, different ideas of what the Union means. One is the supranational Union with parliamentary feature, which is the classical traditional position of people that in some way set up the European Union since the Rome Treaties in 1957. The second is the intergovernmental union, a sort of ad hoc organization based on national government. And then there is the economic community idea of the European Union, in particularly the idea coming from Britain. So the theory that you, if you deal with the debate on the constitutional identity of the European Union, you have this permanent theory of the so-called constitutional pluralism. So this theory of the constitutional pluralism has tried to rob the constitutional implication of those different perspectives. The EU connect the formal constitution of its member state with the material constitution of the treaties. And the reciprocal dialogue between national constitution and the treaties would bring a sort of mutual recognition of the national constitutional tradition, and from that an evolution towards a sort of constitutional framework. I call into question this theory of constitutional pluralism. I think this theory is part of the problem rather than being part of the answer. And I call into question this theory because the multiple crises that we have in the last 10 years, the euro crisis, the migration crisis, the terrorist crisis, have shown that the coexistence between those perspectives within the same legal framework is no longer possible. And indeed, Brexit celebrates the end of this unitary idea of the Union, states moving in the same direction, although at different speed, toward what Spinelli and others call the United States of Europe. I think this narrative, this teleology is finished, and we have to think in a different way to the European Union. Okay, so here I look at the constitutional implication of these three perspectives. The three perspectives that are already there since 1973 with the first enlargement, when Britain, in particular Ireland and Denmark, entered in the European Union. The first one is the economic community perspective. Indeed, Britain entered in the European Union when the European Union was called the European Economic Community. And that position to enter in a market regime has been a consistent position of the political elite in Britain, left and right. Especially the continental European, the Brussels leadership, never accepted this realist approach to Britain. They thought that, you know, Britain with the time would evolve in the direction of being a sort of European-oriented nation state, but that, as we know, has not been the case. So the critical juncture is Maastricht. When in Maastricht we were obliged, or we chose, in order to resolve, to deal with the question of German unification of 1990, in Maastricht, as you know, the intergovernmental conference was in 1991, the Maastricht Treaty has been signed in 1992. In Maastricht, it was launched, the project of an economic and monetary union, with the idea of a euro as a single currency in order to bring Germany within a larger monetary and economic framework. But exactly when the continental European member state moved in that direction, UK, Denmark, and Sweden de facto, namely the previous European free trade agreement member state, did not follow. They could not accept this increase and deepening of the integration. For them, Europe meant basically an economic community, a market regime. So they were allowed to stay out, to opt out of the economic and monetary union. So we found this important constitutional clause, the opt-out clause, in order to celebrate a fundamental compromise between member state of the European Union moving in the direction of a deeper integration in order to rob this growing role of Germany and other member states that did not want to follow in this direction. And for continental Europe, Germany is the problem of the problem. It's always there. You know, it's the largest country, it's so large that it can affect the behavior of other member states, in particular of the smaller member states, but is not sufficiently large to behave autonomously, independently. Germany is strong within the European Union, but as a country outside the European Union, is not as strong as in the European Union. So that debate was solved with the idea of launching the Economic and Monetary Union. But Britain in particular said no. And in that debate, Britain made clear that there are three bastions that cannot be called into question for Britain, namely national sovereignty. What does it mean, national sovereignty is an open question, because indeed Britain was obliged to abide by many rules approved in Brussels. The other one, that, you know, we are in Europe in the European integration process because we want just to maximize our economic advantages, not just for other reasons. And third, the centrality of domestic democracy, in particular Westminster as the bastion of national democracy. So for this approach, the EU does not need to have a constitution. There is no need at all to give a constitution to a market. The multiple crises have shown that the centrifugal pressure cannot be regulated through interstate cooperation. The EU, notwithstanding what the Brits think, is more than a market regime. And of course, Brexit is the dramatic epitome of this misunderstanding, of this misconception. Indeed, the way in which Brexit happened is an example of the misunderstanding of the British political elite of what the EU is. Indeed, we will witness a long period of difficult discussion for organizing the secession of Britain. It's, in some way, Brexit is also the failure of British elite, traditionally considered among the best elite in the Western world. Second, there is the parliamentary union perspective. So let's see what kind of view the parliamentary union perspective, traditionally Italy, Germany, till the unification of 1990, certainly Spain, Portugal. This country had this idea that the European Union should become a parliamentary federal state. And in Maastricht, there was a sort of compromise, a second compromise. There was a compromise saying, okay, we keep this idea of Europe as a federal state in the making with reference to the single market policy, the large majority of European Union policy, regulatory policies of the single market. But we do not maintain the same supranational approach for dealing with the policies that we are considering that period strategic, the new policy, because in Maastricht, European had to deal with the question of foreign policy, defense policy, law and justice, internal affairs, and of course the economic policy of the Economic and Monetary Union. So for those policies, the French in particular were not at all, let's say, consistent with the idea of following the supranational path, because in the supranational path the European Parliament would become more and more important, and the French fear to be, you know, less capable of affecting the European Parliament than the German, because the German became 82 million countries, where the French remain 64, 65 million countries. So here there was the second crucial compromise. And so we have a supranational constitution for regulating the single market policies, which, you know, are a very important part of the European Union. And this supranational constitution was basically an expression of the idea that the EU should become a federal state, a federal state. The German influence was strong in this regard, with parliamentary feature, like Germany, a federal state with two chambers, one of them, the Bundestag, the core of the decision-making process of that country. So here you have the development of an idea of a constitutional state that is a sort of nation state at large. And the community method, integration through law, constitute a foundational principle of this view. We want to build up a sharing power system where national sovereignty are shared with the European institution. And the neo-functional rationale, that is a long school of thought that is called neo-functionalism, assumed that more integration would bring more integration would bring more supranationalization. So more crisis you have, the crisis would be solved through more integration. And so here the idea was, let the people working in Brussels, the commission, the civil servant working in Brussels, operate in order to find solution that spill over to a step forward in the direction of a federal state. However, this is not, has not been the case. However, supranationalization is based on the idea that you have a decision-making center within the European Union, organized, constructed on the relation between the European Parliament and the Commission. That is the fulcrum of the European Union decision-making process for this perspective. And this fulcrum, like parliamentary system, operate under the supervision of the European Court of Justice, whose decision creates the cultural ground for a sort of supranational constitution. So the parliamentary election of the Commission President constitute a strategic innovation for moving the EU in this direction. The Spitzenkandidat of the last election, the European Parliament election of 2014, May 2014, is an example of that. We have Juncker as the president of the European Commission because he was nominated the Spitzenkandidat of the Europe People's Party, the Christian Democrats, and the Europe People's Party got the plurality of vote in the European Parliament, so the Spitzenkandidat of the European People's Party should be the president of the Commission. There are many good arguments for doing that. The Commission has become is more linked to the majority of the Parliament, interprets its role more in political terms. However, the Commission has not become what many people in this direction expected. Many decisions were taken, think to the Greek crisis, without any role at all by Juncker and the Commission. The decision, the most crucial decision regarding migrants, regarding the euro crisis, regarding terrorist threat, were taken by the prime minister within the European Council, were taken by the head of states and government. So why it is so difficult to move in the direction of a parliamentarization of the European Union? My answer is that because those parliamentarist approach are too ideological. They don't consider the structural condition that makes parliamentary system possible. And in this case, I identify two basic conditions that preclude the parliamentarization of the European Union. Again, I do understand that to parliamentarize the European Union is part of European tradition of democratizing our nation state. You know, we cut the head of the king, we bring the king or the cabinet within the parliament. To bring the king into the parliament is the battle cry of the Democrats in Europe since the Glorious Revolution in Britain in 1688. So the idea was to bring the king into the parliament, in this case the commission into the European Parliament. But you do that and you discover that that king is not at all the king. The king is in another place. And so this failure to transform Juncker in the true king should be explained. Otherwise we follow rhetoric and ideology and we don't understand facts. And the reason for that is that the European Union cannot become a parliamentary system for two reasons. First, because of the demographic asymmetry between its member states. So you cannot have a parliamentary system when you have Cyprus with less than around, or Malta with around 400,000 inhabitants, and Germany with more than 80 million inhabitants. There are asymmetry that cannot be cut out through a sort of left and right politics. Why you cannot have left and right politics? Because this demographic asymmetry also cross national differentiation. And there are differentiation in terms of language, cultural and values. And so you cannot put together the European citizen without considering the states to which they belong and the nationality, the national identity that they have. So this is, it cannot work. It could work in Germany, first because they created new Länder. So if you look in Germany, the majority of the Länder are hyphenated. They were invented ex novo after the Second World War. But in Germany, you have an homogeneous political culture that you don't have and you cannot have in national differentiation Europe. So here, instead of to move towards the federal state with the federal constitution, we did step backward during the crisis. And indeed, we are much more divided than we are in the previously. There are much more contradictions between member states because we cannot solve those conflicts in terms of left and right. Because the left and right, basically in Germany, is completely different from the left and right in other member states. And in any case, left and right in Germany play a secondary role vis-à-vis the national interest of Germany to protect national economic policy and national social interest of that country. So it doesn't make any sense to think that you can change economic policy of the European Union through left and right. The conflict in the European Union is between states, not between parties. So here is the point of this misunderstanding comes the fact that in Europe, when we talk about federalism, we always think about states. The concept of federalism is strongly connected to the concept of states. And this is why we continuously make mistakes. And we do not distinguish between a federal union and a federal state. The federal states come from the disaggregation of a previously unitary state. And that disaggregation is justifiable by democratic criteria. They need to be close to the citizen. But the federal union comes from the aggregation of previously independent states. And the logic of aggregation is very different from the logic of disaggregation. So they are federation, but federation is a genus with different species, the federal state and the federal union. We come from the aggregation of previously independent states. We don't come from the disaggregation of a previously unitary state. This kind of mistake continue to be done, in particular by the German leadership. So then there is the third view, the post-constitutional view, what I call the intergovernmental union. So as I said before, the Lisbon Treaty has led to the institutionalization of an intergovernmental union in strategic policies, foreign policy, defense policy, migration, the economic policy of the Eurozone. In this policy, Commission and Parliament do not play any role at all. The decision-making process is monopolized by the European Council, the Council of the Prime Minister, and by the Council of Ministers. Who decided the allocation of quota? The Commission can say to the Hungarian government, you have to accept this kind of quota of Syrian refugees, but the decision is taken by the European Council, and the member of the European Council can oppose, can veto that decision, where in single market policy, in the regulatory policy of the single market, if the Commission say to Apple, you have to pay your taxes back to the Irish government, although the Irish government doesn't want to have the money, nevertheless, the Commission has the authority to impose to a government his own, the respect of his own rules. You cannot do that in this strategic policy. You cannot impose nothing in the intergovernmental union. So, and if you look, the crisis in the last 10 years happened exactly in those strategic policies. We don't have a crisis of the single market. We have the crisis in foreign defense policy, in migration policy, in the economic policy, in all the policies that in Maastricht were the second and the third pillar or are part of the special regime of the economic and monetary union. So in this kind of perspective, which is basically a French perspective, now become German perspective, because Germany operate perfectly well. This view fits perfectly well the fact that Germany is now the leading and powerful country, because in this perspective, what matters is the role, the stability, the economic force, the social cohesion of a given state. And there are, in this perspective, in which the decisions are taken around the table in the European Council between 28 prime ministers, if you represent a strong a credit of state, you matter more than you represent a small debt of state. So apparently, as Angela Merkel say, this is a way for creating solidarity out of cooperation. This is not cooperation, because there are conflict of interest between certain state and other state, because for Germany it's important to stop the Syrian refugee, and so Germany want to make agreement with Turkey, but for Italy it's much more important to stop the migrants coming from Africa. So where you put the money? To Turkey or to African countries? To Turkey, not to African countries, because Germany matters much more than Italy. And I can give you many, many examples of that. So here we don't have the classical supranational constitution with the interplay between separate institutions that I explained before. The role of the Commission is limited, it's a technical service. The role of the EP is very limited. Where there was the debate on Greek aid? There was a debate on the Greek aid in the European Parliament? No! We were waiting last summer, the 2015 summer, we were waiting the debate in the Bundestag, not in the European Parliament. So it was the Bundestag that mattered much more than Parliament of other countries to decide whether we can follow the support of the Greek government or not. The Bundestag or Angela Merkel. But Angela Merkel and the Bundestag were elected by their own citizens, and they take decisions on behalf of other citizens. They were never involved in the election of the Chancellor and the Parliament. So here we are entering in a very complicated situation where there is no legitimacy, there are hierarchy, a division between states, and of course people is very unhappy. What is coming out, Italy is an example 2 days ago, but what is coming out in Europe is the fact that the voters don't have the power to vote their own government, because the government at the national level does not matter. Many decisions are taken in Brussels, but at the same time they cannot vote in Brussels because there is no a supranational democracy with the duty, the charge, the power to take those decisions. So what do they do? And because we don't know what they do, we call them populist. But populist is what the elite does not understand. In many cases, populism is the inevitable reaction of a situation like this one. So here, I would say that this perspective, that we don't need to have a constitution, we are a post-constitutional union, as many people in this direction say, in particular in France, but again, Germany is now the most relevant supporter of this view. This idea that you don't need a constitution has shown to be false. In fact, the Euro crisis, the migration crisis, the terrorist crisis show that there are divisions between states, that there are a hierarchy, that there are no legitimate decisions. At that point, without a constitution, how you deal with those negative effects? So I just run to my conclusion. So if the parliamentary union assume the constitutional pluralism will evolve towards a common constitutional framework, the intergovernmental union assumed that national constitution will remain the indisputable sources of legitimacy. So in both cases, you have a statist view, because the parliamentary union think to the European Union as a larger state than the national state, but similar. The difference is only in the magnitude. But the other, look at the Eurozone, is another statist view. We have a centralized organization. These decisions are taken in Brussels, basically by the European Council and the Council. The Commission is just the bad cop that has the duty to implement those decisions. But you don't have any chances to be, in disagreement with those decisions. It's a sort of centralization without democratization. And so these two views, once you recognize that the economic community, the British view, is out of the picture, these two views cannot work. And in some way, we cannot continue to follow the implicit, in many cases, explicit idea that the European Union of the future should be a state. This cannot be the case. Because we have to create a union, not a state. We have to move in the direction of a federal union, not of a federal state. And if we understand this distinction, we also understand the constitutional implication of this distinction. And here is the fact that the federal union are organized with constitution that separate the level, the supranational federal level and the level of the states, and not with constitutions that integrate the level. What we are doing today is moving in the direction of a closer and closer integration in terms of centralization. But once you have a dissymmetric and differentiated union of states, you cannot centralize, because decentralization in this kind of union means that the larger states matter much more than the smaller states. The richer states matter much more than the poorer state. This is not a union of equals. And we didn't do the European Union for creating neocolonial relations within an integration project. It doesn't work, but also is absolutely wrong. So that creates implication of implosion of the union, not of strengthening of the union. So I run to my conclusion. So at that point, we have to distinguish, to consider that the euro has make the European Union differentiated, that there is a eurozone that is obliged, willing or unwilling, to move in the direction of a more genuine economic integration, and there are an area that does not want to enter in a deeper process. And this area is represented by Britain and the Scandinavia, but also by many Eastern European countries. I considered that already in that period, that there was a lot of ambiguity, as I wrote in my book, about that enlargement. I discussed that with my old professor, Romano Prodi, that he was the president of the Commission. I think that there was a sort of naivete, typical of those who think that rhetoric can substitute politics. Don't do that, young students that are here. So in order to create a union of equals, we have to think that first we have to recognize this differentiation. that there is within the European Union an area that require, need, necessitate integration, and an area that just want to stay in a market. Between these two areas, we have to find a way of creating differentiated constitutional arrangement. So we have to create a union of equals, which a political character, and just to have an interstate treaty for organizing the single market. But the constitution that we have to think about for a union, not for a state, for a federal union, not for the federal state, can be only a constitution with a political nature. We cannot have the same constitution that we had at the national level, where there is a lot of a demos, a lot of culture, civilization, union of states aggregate around specific, limited political values. They are there, they speak different language, they have different cultural religious values, they have in many cases different economic interests. What they share is just a political need to stay together. Federal union come out from necessity, not from love. We don't need to love each other for staying together. What we stay together because we need to stay together, and what we keep us together is politics, the political values of democracy, of liberal democracy. We have to enter in that perspective and think to a political union in which there is no government as such, because asymmetry between states preclude the idea that we have a government as a last decision-making institution. No government. You have to take decision without a government, but through separated institutions sharing power. But also a union does not need to have a state, because if you have a state, you have a framework that can include but also control the states that constitute the union. So we have to invent a way of staying together without a government and without a state, but with a clear understanding of what politics can do for us. Thanks very much. This is the book that tried to make this argument.
Many thanks, Professor Sergio Fabbrini, for such a wonderful presentation, and that opens a lot of areas for discussion. Who would like to ask questions? Robert, please, we have some time.
Thank you very much, Sergio. What a fascinating presentation, and I think a very compelling, you present us with a very compelling view about the multiple understandings of what the European Union is and the consequences of the differences between those understandings. I have two questions that are interrelated. The first one is, what does your union of states or federal union of states imply for, does it imply an increase or a recovery of previously lost sovereignty for national states? What does it imply for what national states can do? And secondly, could you say something about the place of the European Central Bank in all of this? Because the European Central Bank, as a very specific component of the overall EU system, has an enormous importance for all kinds of aspects of political and economic life in Europe. And I would invite you to say something about the role of the ECB, any changes that you see needed there as part of your overall prescription for Europe's future.
Let's see. The first question is very intricate question, because I would say that the discussion to have more Europe or less Europe is fruitless from my perspective. What I try to argue is that in many cases we have too much Europe, and in other cases we have too less Europe. The real question is that we move in a direction, I think, to the Eurozone, in which the true principle was convergence. And so in order to have convergence, and in order to avoid moral hazard, the German imposed rules and not politics, pushing all the member states to become, of the Eurozone, to become like Germany. So to transform the olive oil of Greece in the new Mercedes. But of course, that cannot function. So what I mean that we need to stop a moment. Next year, in March 25, will be the 60 years anniversary of the Treaty of Rome. So it's time to make a checkup of what is going on, right? And say, we have to stop a moment and think, it is necessary that any crucial decision of national democracy are controlled by the European Commission through the decision of the European Council. I don't think so. I think that if you, avoid national democracy of its own salience, citizens would despair. They don't know what to do. But why we went in that direction? Because we did not create a constitutional for a union. For example, can we continue to think to a budgetary organization of the Eurozone and the European Union based on transfer of national transfer that in some way move from a richer state to the poorer state? No, because if you have a direct transfer of money from California to Nebraska and California indirectly give a lot of money to Nebraska, but if you have a direct transfer of money, probably you would have a reaction in California. We give too much, and the reaction in Nebraska. We don't want to be humiliated. We need to have a budgetary, a fiscal capacity at European, the Eurozone level, dependent on Euro taxes, not on national transfer. But if you have a fiscal capacity at the European or the Eurozone level, then you have to have some political bodies responsible for the management of those fiscal capacity. And your experience, the experience of your country, is an example that there is not only one view or only one road to democratic governance, namely the parliamentary road. There are other roads, what they call separation of power system, in which you can take decision without having a government as ultimate decision-making body. Indeed, I don't want to enter in the detail. As I said to Marina, I think that we can move in some very close to semi-presidential system justified by separation of power. So where the President of the Commission, the President of the Council, European Council can, co-decide, but both should be elected in a way that give them legitimacy for taking those decisions. But I don't want to enter in the detail. If you have the time, have a look to the last chapter of the book. This is why I accepted with pleasure to discuss my presentation in this conference, because in some way I go in a direction of a sort of semi-presidential decision-making framework in the European Union. So, but that also brings me to the European Central Bank. The European Central Bank has, in some ways, saved Europe in these 8 years, 9 years. I think the fact that the Central Bank is a federal institution whose decisions are taken through majority logic made possible for the Central Bank to be the only institution able to deal with market speculation, with the transformation of the financial assets. In the European Central Bank, Germany found itself, the German representative found itself several times in the minority. Indeed, two members of the board of the Central Bank, two German members of the board of the Central Bank resigned because they did not accept to be in the minority within the board. But that decision, those decisions, saved the euro. So, of course, we cannot maintain a governance through veto or consensus as the Germans want. We have to find way of taking decision through majority, some form of majority voting. But that majority voting should be justified in democratic terms, which is not the case now.
Monica Britvieni.
Can you do it in English so I can follow better?
Surely.
Thanks very much.
When you were speaking about the difference
between... Take the microphone.
Oh, sorry. It's too far. So when you were thinking or distinguishing between federal union and federal state, I was thinking of Andrew Raffold as a book on constituencies, and he proposes for the United States the creation of arbitrary constituencies by complete random choice of who belongs to them, and that would be a way of constructing, in an imaginary experiment, a state. Or trying to force the construction of a state. This is a playful note on that. But I was just wondering if you could
when you said this is not a union, needs not be a union of love, it needs to be a union of necessity, okay? I just wanted you to elaborate on those necessities that bind us together, because I think that would bring to clarity what we do need. So I'm troubled by your idea of no government. And one of the reasons is because I think the European Union has a very weak international profile. With the rising menace of Russia, etc., I wonder whether that's sustainable with a no-government solution. So I would want you to elaborate on necessity and the external profile the Union would have. And finally, the question would be, how do we get there? Because it seems that the conditions are terrible for getting to anything you are proposing. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thanks to you. Necessity means, for me, a clear word, no longer wars. And necessity is that to end the long story of European civil war. But this is a personal assessment. I grew up in a family in which I was prohibited to learn German. Because my father was captured, he was a partisan, he was captured by Germans during the Second World War, he was tortured and so forth. So when I grew up, he said, the only thing that you can do here is just not to talk German, never. So learn other languages, but never German. You know, I could say to my dad, you know, but, you know, it's also Engels, Marx, and many other wrote in German, you know, but that was the generation of my father's wisdom, stop war, and the Germans were considered responsible for that kind of war. So, but then we know that also without war we can also grow, and this economic growth depends on the fact that we prefer trade than fight. But also we also learn that the continental European countries, in this sense Britain and the Scandinavia are different, need to find some protection to the evil that destroyed their own democracy in the past. Because from Lisbon to Minsk, all the states between the two world wars were conquered by totalitarian or authoritarian regime. Okay? So from that point of view, necessity is, can we protect our peace, growth, and democracy by ourselves? My answer is no. So if somebody can show me, can bring evidence, as the Americans say, bring me evidence that it's possible to protect democracy, for example, through the nation state, I think I would be happy to understand those evidence, but I don't see any evidence at all. So necessity means we need to make a pact. It's not a marriage of love, it's a marriage of interest. I'm sorry to say that, but then we can learn each other to stay together, so you can learn to appreciate Italian mozzarella, and probably I can learn to appreciate some Portuguese food. But that is not the idea, that we need to have a demos in order to create the union. It's a German idea coming out from the experience of that country. They needed, during the Romanticism, to invent the demos in order to protect the boundary, the cultural boundary, vis-a-vis the French expansion. And then how you define your demos? Of course, in order to define your demos, you ended up in defining the demos in blood term, in biological term. And when you define the demos in biological term, it's easy that you can define the demos in racial term. And when you define the demos in racial term, it is easy that some guys in some trattoria of Vienna found, why don't become the dictator of this situation? So I think that we cannot be a demos. We are European demoi, and we have to maintain our distinction and to learn to have a dialogue on the basis of our distinction. So what can take all together is politics, not some kind of cultural values. And I think that if we don't understand that, if we don't have leadership for doing that, it will be very difficult. So I cannot wait the formation of European demos, also because I do not agree with the formation of European demos. From a liberal point of view, I would be scaring to have a people of 5 billion inhabitants thinking the same way, talking the same way, and eating the same way, and so forth. Here comes the question of the leadership, how to move in that direction. And I don't know. My answer is, as a scholar, I raise the question, as Karl Popper taught us, you try to raise the right question. It is not up to the scholar to find the right answer. But, of course, here the question is leadership. What do we need more than Brexit, division between East and West, the Euro crisis, an entire generation of young people out of any opportunity and jobs? And then do we need Le Pen as a French president? Do we need, and then we have Donald Trump. What do we need more for thinking in a different way to the future of Europe? What do we need? But again, I do agree with you. When I go to Brussels, I go quite frequently in Brussels, there is the muddling through. Okay, the Brexit, but you know, the Brits were always like that. And the Hungarian, yes, as Carlos said before, you know, but we can keep under control because they are members of the European People's Party. So the idea is a procedural idea, which kind of, we can solve this problem. But the question now is no longer to solve problems, it's to have a vision on Europe. If you don't have a vision of Europe, you don't save Europe.
Thank you, Sergio. I'd like to ask you a question. And it's the way you presented the possible future of Europe in terms of having a federal union, you seem to be alternating in among two scenarios. It's an either intergovernmental scenario or a supranational scenario. And you would advocate for a mixture of both, if I understand. It seems to me we are kind of past that stage, unfortunately. You are suggesting a reversal, to a certain extent, a reversal of decentralization that has produced populism, Brexit, crisis of austerity, etc. But it seems that it's quite difficult to revert the process that has advanced so much. And I was wondering if you talk about leadership. Do you think that there is a role for regional groupings, and in particular, what role would there be for Southern Europe to emerge, and Italy in particular, as a kind of an anti-austerity or a different alternative voice within the Eurozone to the dominant German view? Because I think that if we think about this in terms of variable geometry, the dichotomy countries or supranationalism is perhaps insufficient, and you should also consider this idea of regional interests and countries that together could make a difference. That would be one thing I'd like you to comment. And the second thing is about the demos. I would perhaps provocatively ask you, some authors have claimed that the Eurozone crisis has actually contributed to a European demos, because until the Eurozone crisis happened, Europe was a very distant issue for the majority of electors. And even with the introduction of the euro, people didn't really understand what that meant for their national sovereignty. It's only with the crisis that we in Portugal have to find out what's happening in Greece. We understand that perhaps what happens in the Bundestag has something to do with the decisions in Portugal. We need to know about Brussels. So it's not just about the supranational institutions that are, but there is a politicization that is very in course, that is happening as we speak, that was not there before, and that admittedly could set the stage for a federal, for a supranational government, for the second option, which is quite painful when you're in the middle of it, because there's a lot of centrifugal forces. But you're creating a European public forum, a European public dialogue, and you are creating constituencies that are not country-based; they are transnational.
Okay, let's say, I start from the second question, Marina. Thanks very much for this question. I would say that what we have in the crisis is the formation not of a European demos, but a European public sphere. I follow Habermas' interpretation. So more and more, you open up the newspaper at the national level, and the first page, the second page, the third page is about euro, the euro issue, or the euro zone. And so it's more and more we interpret the problems as common problems, although I would stick to the idea that those problems are interpreted from a national perspective. And here I would say we have a public sphere constituted by different national perspective, but I think that highly legitimate. The idea that the European Union is the overcoming of the nation state is a naive idea that I don't know where does it come from. I look to the Federalist debate that we had in Europe. This idea that you have, you can sell in few decades nation states that have strong roots culturally, institutionally, economically. And so the Federalists in this debate were those who think to Europe as the super state in alternative to the nation state. But this is a silly idea, is a wrong idea. What we can do is a union able to bring those nation state in and to tame them, to make their own nationalism under control, but not negating the substance, the role of the nation state. History cannot be cancelled in a few days. And that is my opinion coming out, for example, the same experience of the US or Duke's experience of the Switzerland, the two other empirical cases of union of states. They did not create a state. They create union. And they take decisions through way of separating power. And come to the question. Rather than to go back to the question, variable geometry, kleb or klebs, because those solutions can be helpful in specific policy, but cannot become the rule of the regime. Because if we are, let's say, scholar, a student of Montesquieu and James Madison, we know that any decision should be legitimized, should be founded in democratic will. So you can solve some policy, how to look, for example, to some question of fishery, and there is a cooperation between certain member states that have this specific problem. But the system should have a democratic foundation. Now, the democratic foundation is not necessarily the democratic foundation that we have in Italy or we have in Germany. And I would say also the democratic foundation that we have in Portugal or in France. We look for different roads to the same aim, how to make democratically legitimate decision taken in Brussels. So first, take an example of the Eurozone crisis. If we had a budget, a Eurozone budget, we can allow a country to fail if the political elite of that country is an irresponsible political elite. As an Italian, I would say that we have to make those elite responsible for what they did not do. I think it's a right principle to let certain region of my country, certain state, to fail because they did not understand, the elite and the citizen, that corruption, bad government generate those outcomes. So you cannot be corrupted and then ask for help. This is a German principle that you should keep in mind if you are a democrat, right? But then, if you fail, you need also to have a counterbalance from other side. You should have a Eurozone budget, a federal budget that invests in these countries in infrastructure. In the US, they create naval bases, air force bases, university, in order to keep those countries or those states on the surface. So you have many possibilities in a union to make political elite and citizens responsible for what they did, and at the same time to help the society of this member state or this country to survive and even to learn how to come out from their own mistakes. But that requires fiscal capacity. You know, the U.S. for a long period of time, the fiscal capacity was 7% of GDP, 7%, 8%. For us, it might be much less, but we need to have federal fiscal capacity based on euro taxes, not on national transfer. But then, who decide the use of those taxes? We have the two. Look at the experience of Switzerland and the U.S. Again, as Tocqueville told us, we have to compare in order to learn, not in order to copy. Okay? So the U.S., you have a separation of power system. You have a president make proposal to the Congress. The Congress is divided between a House and Senate. Each of them is independent, reciprocally independent. They do not need confidence, political confidence. There is a negotiation. That negotiation brought to polarization. Yes, we in Rome 3 days ago, I had a debate with Frank Fukuyama, a friend of mine, and he said, you know, I am very unhappy with the American system. I do understand, but there are ways of reducing the polarization through specific devices. But there, at the end, there is a place where to take decision, although there is no government. There is no government as you have in Rome or you have in Berlin. But nevertheless, you have the governmental decision. You don't have a government, but you have a governmental process. So in that I mean to take decision without imposing the view of one institution on the other, but obliging several institutions representing asymmetric state to have a voice. So Maine, Nebraska, can have, Rhode Island can have a voice in the Senate. I do understand that the Senate is undemocratic, the American Senate. You can abolish filibuster. Nevertheless, the fact that you have the Senate helps the U.S. to stay together. And I do understand that you have 40 senators able to stop any discussion. This is the filibuster. If you look to the 40 senators, they can come from two senators for state. This was the decision taken in Philadelphia. Two senators for states, regardless of the demographic size. Those 40 senators can be the expression of 20 states. And the population of those 20 states might be less than the population of California. So less than 40 million inhabitants, and the population of California, as the state of California, has only two senators. So if you look from a Rousseauian point of view, Jean-Jacques Rousseau said, but this is not democratic. Nevertheless, the small state can have a voice in the Senate that they would not have in the House of Representatives, where the representation is based on population within certain constraints. So that is a compromise between, you want Rhode Island on board, you have to find a compromise. Otherwise, New York or Pennsylvania could have done the union by themselves. But why you make a union? Because you need the union, not because you feel yourself similar to Rhode Island. Think the union of the United States was between slavery and anti-slavery state. What kind of culture in common they had? They just wanted to protect these 13 states from British ambition, from French ambition, and so forth. So I want to say we don't need to follow that path, but we have to consider that if we make a union, there are larger states and smaller states. There are states that are basically Catholic and others that are Protestant. There are states that export and states that do not export. So how to guarantee an equilibrium? I don't see any other strategy than separation of power. But you have to be creative, original, in finding a solution to that. And the Swiss did not follow the American model. Although they took the American model as their own example, they created a collegial executive, for example. And in that regard, there are many other roads to do. I said in the European Union case or the Eurozone case, I would think more similar in terms of semi-presidential system. Anyway, it doesn't matter the specific proposal. The proposal is that we have to recognize that a union of equals should be built on demographic asymmetry and national differentiation, where the state are not built and don't need to be built on those systemic constraints. I think this is a much more difficult project, but it is worthwhile if we don't want to go back to the history. So this is why Marina is right. The only solution now seems to be nationalism. But if we go back to nationalism, we know what does it mean nationalism for us, right? It's not the solution. It's the problem. But it's a problem that is increased by the fact that we do not recognize the nation state. We should neutralize nationalism, but we have to give dignity to the nation state, what Jacques Delors called the Fédération des États Nationaux. It is an oxymoron. I do understand that it is an oxymoron. But that oxymoron is the only way for opening the door, a Fédération des États Nationaux. You have to recognize the role, the historical role of the states, and try to tame them within a union, not under another state. Thanks very much.
Do you want to ask the final question, or should we just perhaps... Yes, very, very quickly.
But I would say that also it was in certain way a problem before. But the first, because we built the European integration project on this Franco-German axis, and the two were sufficiently different in order to let space of room of maneuvering between them for the other states, for example Italy, to broker the tension between them. But this equilibrium, as I mentioned in this book, has been over since October 1990, when Germany unified. Indeed, you know, as you remember, Mitterrand was strongly against. It was George H.W. Bush that called Mitterrand and said, you have to accept this unification, because they understood that this might have consequences for France. But France thought to the European Union or to European integration in terms of an hegemonic project. They thought always that Europe is France at large. And this is the dilemma of the French political leadership, because now they are no longer in the condition to be hegemonic, and they don't have the cultural coalition. So basically they follow Germany, also for out of economic interest, and they are not able to play their role as a great power in the past, but they did not learn how to create the condition for creating institutional leadership. So my answer to the problem is, cannot be Angela Merkel. This is a mistake of Obama. You cannot think that the European Union will be saved by Angela Merkel. Angela Merkel will save Germany, because she was elected or will be elected by Germans. That is her own basic interest. We cannot ask Angela Merkel to take care of Europe. We need to find the institution able to generate institutional leadership of Europe. And that is a question that I would say Germany does not understand, or probably does not want to solve.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Professor Fabrini, for your wonderful presentation. And thanks to all of you for the discussion. We have reached the end of our program, and we are completely over time, but never mind, because we had I think, very fruitful discussion over the day. I certainly learned a lot from all the presentations. They are, I think, very complementary to each other. They, not only within the panels, but across panels, we've gone through a lot today in a comparative perspective, looking at the origins of this third wave constitutions in several countries, the impact of different actors like the military, the Catholic Church, the elite pacts, and then following through to the challenges, to the legacies, the social legacies, and how these legacies are being still are being activated today, and with what difficulties. And then now in the afternoon, the challenges which constitutions face, and this very, very important supranational challenge, which is the European Union and ways forward in what is a very objectively difficult situation. So thank you again very much for being here. And I would like to say something for those of us who are, for those participants who are having dinner. We will meet at 8 o'clock in the lobby of the hotel. And to everybody else who was here, thank you very much for your participation. Thank you. And there is going to be a bus for the participants to go back to the hotel now, more or less. Thank you very much. Wonderful. That was great.